And all righty then. We welcome to the Indie Agent call for the May 8th. This is a Linux Foundation meeting, and Linux Foundation meetings involve participation by industry competitors. And it is the intention of the Linux Foundation to conduct all of its activities in accordance with applicable antitrust and competition laws. It's therefore extremely important that attendees adhere to meeting agendas and be aware of and not participate in any activities that are prohibited under applicable U.S. state, federal, or foreign antitrust and competition laws. Examples of types of actions that are prohibited at Linux Foundation meetings and in connection with Linux Foundation activities are described in the Linux Foundation antitrust policy, available at linuxfoundation.org/antitrust-policy. If you have questions about these matters, please contact your company counsel. If you're a member of the Linux Foundation, feel free to contact Andrew Updegrove of the firm Gesmer Updegrove LLP, which provides legal counsel to the Linux Foundation. Welcome, welcome. We were off last week because IIW was happening in Mountain View, California. Saw many of you there, and that was very good. Lots of interesting conversation. Are there any announcements? We kind of have this announcement here about Hyperledger Aries, but I thought we'd wait until after we do the IIW review stuff, and then we can jump into the Aries stuff. So, any announcements besides anything Aries related? We need to share as a group. I'm hearing crickets. Okay, if there is something, please bring it up or add it in our meeting today so that we can figure that out share the news. I'd like to start this meeting with just an IIW recap and report of conversations or people you met or things you became aware of or anything at all that happened at IIW that you think is of interest to the indie agent community, which I think there's kind of a lot. We had a bunch of good discussions. So I'm going to shut it for a minute.
So the Aries project was announced. Should we talk about that?
I have something else besides Aries that I want to talk about for a second.
Yes, please. I was joking.
we started to explore the topic of committing fraud with credentials, and I'm feeling the need to create some kind of a task force or working group to explore that in greater detail. So I'm looking for advice about a venue or a mechanism that people want to recommend that would see that topic explored a little bit better. Up till now, what we've done is we've created a spreadsheet. If anybody's been in it since IIW, it does have some new data in it. But this is just a very early exploration. I'm looking for collaborators, I guess.
Another item we can add to the list is it seems that we've undersold the future potential of verifiable credentials, especially ZKP-based credentials in the community. I'm working on some of how we can write up some better business level papers on how credentials work, especially how ZKPs work and why they're valuable. And then we also probably ought to have more discussions at this level with this group around use cases that are made possible by some of the new cryptography techniques that allow us to do more token-like things in terms of transferable assets, and also credentials where the subject is not the holder, but the subject is more like a crypto token where it's transferable to whoever owns or controls a particular property of the credential.
With regards to that, the idea of like locked credentials, people were asking questions about that, and a specific interest when explaining the use cases to Uport, they found it very useful. And consider that a very valuable reason to use ZKPs, or at least one where that it would give them reason to consider it. So something that clarifies that type of technology as well would be cool.
Well, and the other
one, what's a locked credential?
Where the issuer has to pay, or the verifier has to unlock a secret with either the issuer or the issuer's or the ledger or some delegate of the issuer in order to access or verify the proof. So the idea of a locked credential is outlined in Sovereign's premiums and the Sovereign token white paper that talks about premium credentials, but it's also very useful for other cases where you might want to control the flow of data in the sense that only certain parties may have access to a verification of a proof.
Okay, that was a lot all of a sudden. Let me rewind just slightly to Daniel Hartman. You were asking about a venue or mechanism to explore credential fraud. I'm assuming you're talking about like sort of an online venue or a collaborative mechanism to do that. Is that?
Yeah, I mean, for example, we could say, look, there's a task force of interested people, and we could certainly draw from our own community here, but I think it needs to be a broader set of people than just indie people. The topic of the security of linked secrets came up at IIW, and I had a whole session, Reuven called it, but we had a whole session on that. But I think it's the phenomenon of fraud with digital credentials is broader than just the issue of linked secrets. And we need to actually publish something about it. Now, I could bring this up to the Verifiable Credentials Working Group, but I'm a little bit reluctant to do that because my perception is that that group moves very slowly. And I also am not trying to create a standard here. All I'm trying to do is create some kind of methodical exploration of the topic that can be referred to by many different people. So the output is probably more like a white paper than it is like a W3C standard.
Who in terms of like audience outside of indie would you like to be a part of this?
Well, ideally I'd like to have somebody like Daniel Burnett, who was at IIW and came to the session and would represent kind of the W3C mindset pretty deeply. I'd love to have some people from other credential communities. For example, somebody representing the Veris One Digital Bazaar viewpoint, somebody representing kind of the Microsoft JWT UPort kind of a style of credential. I'd love to have a security Nazi and teach us some things.
I think we should probably.
It would be great if we had somebody who has thought deeply about many of these scenarios for many years.
This would make a really good.
I guess I'm looking for a place to hold the conversation.
This would make a really good introduction to the Aries project because most of those folks we want to get involved anyway. I think we should also try as hard as we can to volunteer Dave Huseby to help on some of the security analysis side. And of course, obviously Mike Lauder can help, but other folks who are perceived as more neutral within the community would be really helpful for that.
This is weird because it's a little bit like credentials, but you're right, Daniel. It's not a standard we're trying to create, but rather sort of a scope of the attack surfaces and of various approaches and things like that. So it's a little bit different. It's not exactly core to Aries, but it's certainly peripheral to Aries.
What I was going to suggest was just trying to set up like impromptu calls to the CCG group that are not like on the CCG times, because that's where you're going to hit your broadest audience. Because there's going to be plenty of people who are not aware of Aries, particularly I know nobody in Aries 1 is aware of it at this point. And so I think that's something to consider if you're trying to hit that kind of broad audience.
All right, well, I'll send a message to the CCG and ask them what they think about it and see if I can get anybody to participate with me. But if I think I would be happier doing it under the sponsorship of Hyperledger in some way, because I think it's, I don't know. I like the community management processes that we're using in Hyperledger a bit more than I like the ones that are used in the W3C. So
yeah,
maybe that's
absolutely
prejudice on my part. I don't know.
I mean, it also fits in line with Hyperledger's working group. Like I'm thinking Identity Working Group is putting out a white paper. So maybe this is something that falls in line with their thinking. However, they don't typically get that audience as well as I know they struggled with getting out a white paper in the past. So some other things to think about in terms of keeping it inside there. It's mainly what I'm thinking about is the audience factor. You can advertise on others and say, here's where we're hosting it.
I think what I'd recommend, Daniel, is just get started and invite the people or reach out to the organizations you would love a representative from, and then just sort of just charge ahead. And if we find that support of, you know, Hyperledger or anything else is useful, I don't know, use to the wiki or a mailing list or something, then I think that Hyperledger would certainly be willing to sponsor that. So I think that this is like a let's move and then see where it fits rather than trying to see where it fits and then move.
Okay, I'll do that. So for anybody who's on this call who's interested, reach out to me and let me know, and I'll hook you into what I'm doing, and pass the word along if you know of anybody you think would be interested in this topic.
Yes, and Daniel Hardman is on. Can you add your? Oh, you're on your phone, aren't you, Daniel?
I am right now, but I'll be in at my laptop in a couple minutes.
Okay, if you add yourself to the attendees list, then we'll have your email address, and then you're also on Rocket Chat as well.
This is perfect. Anybody who wants to commit fraud?
This is good people that are surmising how people might want to commit fraud so that we can plug those holes.
I was trying to join for that as well, Ken. I got to keep track of how they're defending it so I know how to keep moving forward.
Yeah.
I was trying to avoid calling it the Evil League of Evil or something like that. So, but no, we have to do this in order to discuss the various merits of various approaches and have rules or guidelines as a community about good things to do and bad things to do. So, Daniel, I appreciate your effort both starting that IW session and getting the conversations going. Okay, so I think we're done with that topic. Nathan, you talked briefly about the clarifying the scope of ZKPs.
So there's a couple of things to mention here. One is when you do a zero knowledge proof signed credential, the transferability of the proof has different properties than just a regular signed credential. And we need to figure out a better way of talking about that and talking about those qualities and why and how they're helpful. We also need to do a better job of talking about the future of what's going on in the crypto community around what new things are possible with credentials. We had a session at IIW about this and talked a little bit about the idea of a credential that's transferable and how that affects the track and trace supply chain use cases where more things can be modeled as credentials and you don't have to revoke and reissue in order to accomplish updating information on a credential, but rather the credential can follow the object itself or can be wrapped or rewrapped with additional attributes and use composite proofs to accomplish what you need to do. We also talked about the idea of locked credentials and how locked credentials can make essentially kind of a ratchet mechanism or a zippering mechanism where a chain of these credentials that is transferable could have different properties of unlocking in order to reveal or unblind escrowed data, similar to kind of the identity escrow that we see talked about in some of the IDEMIC research. So there's a lot of different options that become available once we get to the non-creds 2.0 phase of having more mechanisms for blinded attributes from both the issuer and the holder. And it would be good to explore some of those from a use case standpoint as we go forward into the Aries community. I think one of the big things here, and John Jordan and the BC crew are the ones that have been really good at driving this into my mind, is that we need to be able to talk about verifiable data flows in a way that doesn't put them into a box of it's just about identity, which most people think of as like user and account management kind of things. The things that are possible with credentials flows go beyond that, and we need to get better at talking about and emphasizing kind of why that makes such a big difference.
Okay. So that was a bunch of good stuff to talk about, and that was prefer related to IIW. Let me reel it back in just a little bit to things that happened at IIW or sessions that were held or topics that were brought up that were related to this community.
Might be worth talking about the identity hub versus indie agents discussions that were had. I think I heard rumor you, Sam, were on further discussions with Daniel about that. You want to talk a bit about that?
Let me outline that a little bit, and then I'd love to hear about the demos by various parties in this group, but just a quick outline of those. That would be, I think, useful for anyone that wasn't able to attend. We ended up having a series of conversations about trying to identify common patterns within the broader SSI ecosystem and how to and what we can do to converge on those. So that was with Hubs, but also with Uport and Civic and Dolocom were the three main participants in those conversations. And we talked about the wire level encryption format, and there seems to be general agreement that that's the right direction to head. We have a group of folks using JWTs for signing, and they're relying on transport encryption. And they would like to be transport agnostic, which then requires that you have something that is not transport level encryption. And so the JWE style approach that we have been using and Kyle has worked so much on was more or less generally accepted as the way we should proceed. We need to have another conversation. In fact, I plan to have that next week as part of that conversation about any next steps and as we move forward and the direction that we need to head. We also talked about message typing. We're also really close on that as well. People either used TYP of a JWT or they used the JWE style or JSON-LD style with a context and a type. And we discussed consolidating that into a type itself. And then we also discussed that there are various levels of allowing message family naming. And again, that's a long conversation that I hope to get into next week as well. But there was also broad consensus that this is a good idea, and with a bit of tweaks, it works for about everybody. We also talked about message routing, and that was relatively well received. There's some crossover with concepts in diff hubs there because of some of the synchronization they do. But that was also pretty well received as well. Walking out of there, the guy from Jolocom said, "Hey, we need to talk more about this. I think this fits really well." So there seems to be a pretty good acceptance, and we've done a lot of thinking about this in the indie community. And so as we were able to share what we had been thinking about and what we were proposing, then other communities seemed pretty willing to discuss and figure out something that was common. The deeper discussion, we held a discussion that talked about the actions interface with diff hubs, which is how they manage protocols, that led to a discussion there, that was kind of an ongoing, and it's still ongoing, discussing the relative merits of various approaches. One of the really valuable things that diff hubs has, which there seems to be excitement about adopting into the indie agent community, is the concept of a replicated data store. So that you could place storage in a replicated data store and it would be accessible, with eventual consistency to the other data stores in use in a user's domain as well. And so the concept of a vault has been intentionally excluded from the concept of a wallet in the indie community. And this would be a nice plug to fit in into that architecture. And so we have ongoing discussions about that. And I'm sure that will be some topic of future conversation in the community as well about how to bring those together. But one of the things that the synchronized data store provides is a common mechanism for protocols to store protocol state. That can be replicated to other places, which provides a really cool opportunity for you to begin a protocol with one agent, say on your laptop, and then complete the protocol later on with your phone and have that be managed by the state, by a protocol state store that's part of the synchronized or the replicated data storage. So there's some really cool opportunities there. And I think we finally sort of got to the important parts of the actions interface that the hubs provide and the generic support for those. So what this ends up looking like is that there's a set of message families for the features that the diff hubs typically provide. With all the common other formats like typing and the wire level stuff that we've discussed, that it would be easy for a one piece of software to be both an indie agent in the traditional sense we've thought about it, a diff hub in the traditional sense we've thought about it, or both. And there's nice overlap that we can draw for different purposes. They've started with a very storage oriented approach. We've started with a very message protocol oriented approach. There's really good uses for both, and being able to bring that together actually adds a lot of power to a sort of a unified identity solution, which is pretty valuable. Is that a good summary? Did I miss anything?
No. Can I just make one pedantic comment that we don't call it versus, because that's a hard-fought battle that I've had to bring up with people many times, that they're not as differently aligned as that implies. And so I'd ask that people don't say they're versus, they're just not aligned yet. And it's and.
That was unintentional, but yes, I will try to do better in the future. Versus was a compare and contrast mechanism for me, not a...
Yeah, I'm just saying this in general. I'm not calling out any names or anybody who's done it, because I've seen it all over the place. I used to do it quite a bit, but because the optics of what that creates to people outside the two communities, I've tried to change the language so that they don't see it as very differentiating, and they feel like they can do either or, and things will eventually align.
Yes, and that does appear to be where we're going.
The same as the path forward to just continue that conversation in the storage and compute, so that everyone's aware of how where that conversation will progress. Is that where the discussion will occur?
There will certainly be discussion there. I'm hoping that that also becomes part of the ongoing ARIES discussions, but that's also sort of remains to be seen a little bit. So that conversation will certainly be happening there, and there's some other email threads and conversations happening as well as people reach out directly to reach understanding. So there's some of that going on as well. So that's ongoing development, and I expect we could certainly report on where those conversations are happening in these calls if these calls don't end up being the location for those conversations.
Cool.
Okay. Is there anything I missed about those? That was like five or six sessions that I sort of summarized all at once. Is there anything that I missed from anyone who was there that's relevant? Okay. I'd love to ask those that were involved in demos if they could describe a little bit what the demos were like and where people can find out more. There's been a note added to the docs here about the IW book demo and with a link there that you can go to try it yourself. Will someone volunteer to talk about the demos that were given? Nobody?
I saw a whole bunch of plus ones about people wanted to hear about these demos. And I know that some of the people who did these demos are on the call. Don't be modest. Tell us about what happened.
So I'll talk about IAW book. People can go look at it, as I said. Basically, a mobile agent and two enterprise agent issuers. So you can join the beta program for Street Cred's mobile agent. So you have an iOS mobile agent. Go to a service that's based on the IndyCat agent that will ask you to verify your email address, verify your control over an email address, and then issue you a credential to your Street Cred agent that you own that email address. Then you go to a second IAW book service that will request proof of that credential, the email credential, because it trusts that email service. Once you do that, it goes into a queue handled by a human that checks to see if you're attending IAW. And nowadays, it just checks to see that you have a email credential, because we issue them all the time now. And if so, it issues you a credential of IAW attendee. And then you can use those for proofs. And so it talks about how you would, for example, establish a connection with somebody else on a Street Cred agent, and then do mutual presentations of the credentials you receive from the two services. And then the Matter folks extended that by having a box made by Hobbits that once you proved you were an IIW attendee, it would open the magic box and you could select a sticker from it. very cool.
I don't believe they're on the call here, but the ID Ramp folks showed how you could plug in credentials to a traditional SAML-based demo, and they've got it running, connecting to their own personal instances of Slack and Rocket Chat, which is really cool. And they'll be demoing it tomorrow, I believe, on the Indie call.
Yes, I was going to mention that. Thank you, Kyle. If you want to see that demo, then the call scheduled for tomorrow will have it.
I've got a quick demo that I can actually show, if you want to, which is just showing sort of the ephemeral challenge inspiration.
Go for it. And shared.
Okay, 2 seconds. Can everybody see my screen?
Yep, we see it.
Okay, so this is Proton. This is Matter's mobile wallet. This here is like a fictitious e-commerce website where you're at checkout and you can continue with the exercise. The idea is you don't want to have to fill out your information on the page. You'd rather just in wallet to prove to the website what a challenge is generated, which is the e-commerce site asking for the following information, which is your first and last name to go on the order and your address. And if you accept that, you're now at checkout and it has the following information required to proceed with the order. That's just sort of how we can use that ephemeral challenge type integration to prove to a service with verifiable information without necessarily having to establish. So this is showing sort of the guest flow where I don't really want to have to set up an account with this e-commerce site, so I'm not sure if I'm ever going to use them again. So I'd really just like to prove something in an ephemeral way. So I use my address credential from SparkNZ and my Spark ID to prove that information. So, yeah.
Awesome. Thanks for showing that. Did we cover the demos, or is there more that we missed?
Hey, Sam. So I did a demo for the Universal Resolver, an updated demo. So not exactly an agent, but I figured I'd mention it here because we added support for a bunch of new DID methods, so new drivers. But I think the more exciting thing is we added support for matrix parameters. So after you have the bare DID, you can have a semicolon delimiter and then specify certain aspects of the DID doc that you want. So you can select, for instance, a particular key or a particular endpoint. And then the other exciting thing is that we have built kind of rudimentary support for resolving old versions of DID docs as well. So you would pass in the DID and then a matrix parameter, which just says what was the valid DID doc last Tuesday, or you sort of provide a Unix timestamp, and then the resolver does that, you know, performs the resolution and the integrity check, but for a specific point in time. So it'll reconstruct the state at that point in time using these version trackers, which sort of monitor the DLTs or ledgers, and basically you build a cache. So it's sort of the base layer for DID discoverability or DID search, even reverse lookup, kind of some of these more advanced features around DIDs that we might need as things mature. So that's, like I said, it was a demo and a POC, but we plan on open sourcing those kind of additional features pretty soon.
Very cool. Thanks to Nader and Danube Tech for contributing that work to the community. That's awesome. Others?
I've dropped it in Rocket Chat as well, but perhaps it's worth just pointing it out as well. We open sourced Ozma, which is a full mobile edge agent that uses Agent Framework, which is developed by Street Cred, and we've been contributing to as well. And just encourage everyone to go and check that out. And we really want that to be a project that helps us to progress some of the conversations around mobile edge agents and things like message routing and delivery at the edge. So that project's still in active development. We're working with some at the Sovereign Foundation, and it appears that a couple of people from BC Gov seem interested in it. And go and check it out and ask some questions if you get stuck.
Excellent. And for those of you sharing stuff, if you have links that you can put into the wiki notes for this this meeting, that will make that more accessible for those that were that are looking for it as well. Excellent. Okay. Anything at all IW related demos or topics or things that you learned, other things as well. I'll mention a couple things. There was some really good conversations around the concept of DIDs that were not registered on a ledger. So this was pure DIDs with Daniel's suggestion, but also it appears that the UPort folks have been pursuing the concept that that the initial DID and DIDoc don't actually need to be on a ledger either. So there's some there's actually pretty broad acceptance, I thought, of the concept and the mechanisms and how that work and ongoing discussions. So that was really good to hear. And then there was something else. What was it? I'll think of it later when I'm saying something else. But there were some really good conversations. The demos were really cool to see and sort of sparked a lot of conversation and people interested in getting involved and stuff. So it was a very cool event. Okay, I'm going to leave a slightly awkward pause, but after that awkward pause, then I want to ask Nathan if he will talk about the acceptance of the Ares project a little bit, and then we can go on and discuss the effects that has on this call and in the work that the community is doing. So awkward pause here for any final IW comments. Okay, if something comes up later, please please bring it up. Nathan, will you share a little bit about the Ares project?
Can you see my mouse moving around? Am I in the right window here?
Yep.
Okay, so the Hyperledger Ares project proposal was approved by the Technical Steering Committee at Hyperledger. We actually used one of the IIW sessions to have what we consider our first face-to-face meeting for the project. And you'll see hopefully a few more people sign on as sponsors to the project here over the course of the next couple of days as some more folks hear about it and want to show their support in being maintainers or helping support the project. But you know, we've been talking about this proposal for quite some time in our community. We've been able to write down more precisely some of the scope of the project and how it intends to be ledger agnostic, meaning it supports more ledgers than just Indy and Sovereign. And obviously we've talked extensively about the software stack that's here. But over the course of the next few weeks, we're going to push really hard to get the community set up and running in terms of having discussions. The big priority here is to get people from outside of the Hyperledger Indy project collaborating on requirements and ratifying the specification work, and then take our time to then go ahead and start reorganizing and moving the chunk of code that comes out of Hyperledger Indy into the new Aries repositories once we've had a chance to go through and ratify the standards that are right now in the Indy Hyperpository into the new Aries RFC repository. So we already have a Rocket Chat channel and a couple of the other standard project resources, like a space in the wiki, I believe. I'm not sure if I'm seeing it here, but we should have a few different resources at our disposal to help set the project up and get collaboration started. Like I mentioned before, the Rocket Chat channel has a new Aries channel. So if you go to chat.hyperledger.org/channel/Aries, you will see that Aries channel. And we can start having discussions around the Aries project and the Aries project setup process here. And I expect that we'll be doing some work to clean up the existing Indy repositories and then start renaming some of the pieces as we move them over. When we start thinking about how the project's been managed inside of Hyperledger so far, we have a few different working groups inside of Indy. I expect that the Indy agent group will, for the most part, now be participating underneath Aries. I would expect that the Indy outreach group will split into an Indy and an Aries component, and that there'd be the chunk of the Indy SDK that is the ledger-centric pieces around doing the resolver code will stay in Indy, and then the bulk of the code that's in the SDK layer now will become part of Aries as we do that reorganization and hopefully contemplate some of the refactors that we've wanted to do. One of the groups that's the most interesting here with the split is the Indy Semantics group. There is a lot of work that does play a role in the agent protocol that's coming out of the Indy Semantics group, but for the most part, Indy Semantics is all about the objects that go on the verifiable data registry. So this group, I expect, will stay within the Indy community and do its data model definitions for Indy. And then Aries will support the Indy verifiable credentials data model as one of its verifiable credentials modules. And others are welcome as well as we try to get some of the JSON-LD signature folks and the JWT-based credentials folks participating. So that's kind of an overview for the project being approved and our efforts to try to start setting up mailing lists and a few of the other infrastructure pieces that we need. What questions do people have? I should call out a special thanks to Troy, who's on the call. Right after the Hyperledger Aries proposal was approved, he sent out a bunch of things about how the Secure Key platform can integrate into the new Aries project. And it's given us a lot of stuff to look at and think about. So thanks to everybody who's been reaching out as the project was approved. And I'm looking forward to a lot of new partners to collaborate with as we try to make this thing come together more quickly.
Small question. I see. Did peer-did in the Aries project. So does it mean that peer-did is no longer part of the Indy project?
So certainly we expect that Sovereign will depend on peer-dids. But because Aries is a ledger-neutral implementation, it makes sense that the peer-did implementation will live inside of the Aries project because it lets us test everything in an independent standalone way, meaning if you have two agents, they can talk to one another, do their key exchanges, and do effectively engage in protocol without having to pull in any external dependencies.
Okay, thank you.
Hey, Nathan, it's Troy. Thanks for the call out.
Hey, Nathan, I'm curious, when we say Aries is ledger agnostic, what layer of the stack are we talking about, or is it kind of left somewhat open-ended in terms of DID layer, credential exchange layer, just on the layer of the resolver? Or?
Yeah, so we haven't followed the diff stack decomposition inside the Sovereign community the same way some others in the diff community have. So we don't usually split out a DID layer per se in the system because we don't rely on DIDs for cross-signing and some of the other things that are needed in credentials. We usually like to think of it more as a wallet layer or a secrets management layer, and of which DIDs are one type of secret that tie into that. We think about the Indy project is now effectively a verifiable data registry implementation. So it's that public oracle that can be used for validation. And then Aries has kind of the core infrastructure for messaging from one identity to another. And that includes this wallet interface layer that can talk to different DID methods, but also talk to other crypto hardware security modules and other things that help you manage and control secrets. And then we have different protocols that are implemented on top of that messaging infrastructure. So anything that's considered kind of core functionality that any identity agent would need to implement in order to talk to others, we think of those as things that will belong inside of the Core Aries project, namely verifiable credentials, decentralized key management, messaging, import-export, wallet backup, that sort of thing.
Gotcha. So it's more of that generic kind of protocol rather than having like a single location for a bunch of like chain-specific functionality.
The truth is it's anyone who implements the same data model can act as a verifiable data registry, and that has a lot of interesting implications because it's often the case that you don't want to publish something into the full public sphere, but you want to publish it just within the participants in that context. And so we don't have to have a very strong distinction between stuff that goes on the public ledger and stuff that's shared privately at the Aries level. Aries is about making sure that you can interact with those data models and that you can communicate verifiable information between the parties who have access to the data. And then the Hyperledger Indy project concerns itself with saying the public context that you can use for pivoting meaning between different pairwise relationships.
The practical effect of this is that we tend to think of software as relating to a ledger. So I have software that uses Ethereum, or I have software that uses, you know, the Bitcoin ledger. And this inverts a little bit. And so rather than having the ledger that software is hung off of, I have software at the center that can call out to multiple ledger services as needed to support the efforts or the, you know, its activities. So it inverts the stack just a little bit to a really positive effect.
So question regarding that, does that mean that we will support multiple different credential data models in terms of like how they're anchored to ledgers? I know we've talked about JWTs, which implies that we're going to support that, but does that also mean that the resolvability of JWT-based credentials that are on other ledgers are going to be resolvable through the Aries project?
Absolutely.
Okay. And would that also mean that we would support ZKP style credentials that are anchored to a different ledger?
The answer is yes. It's obviously got to exist, but the short answer is that will the Aries project work to integrate with insert your favorite identity thing here, you know, or you know, as far as credentials or data models or whatever? And the answer is yes, right? This we recognize the role of an agent as being able to interact with both ledger-based data's data models as an oracle, and also communicate directly as a really general pattern. And so the Aries product is designed to approach that generically, not just for the ones we know about today, but as new ones come along, as we have new advancements in crypto or credentials formats and everything else, that we anticipate building that in. Now, that's the scope of the project. The actual practical application, this is an open source project, right? Which means that the stuff that gets work done to it will be integrated sooner. But the goal is to be able to support any of those and all of those into the Aries project. Other general questions? And then after that, I want to attempt to outline the what does this mean for the community right now and what does it mean in the future? So that's what I'd love to talk about next. But another awkward pause for any final comments on this scope.
So basically the Java one just becomes, we'll just use the art of math and how it is built, depends, whatever.
Okay. I'll call that a sufficient awkward pause. If you have other questions, please bring them up. there is a wiki space for the Aries project, and I have, given that the bulk of what we talk about, the vast majority of it, is not unique to Indie itself, but rather agents in general. The proposal is that we keep this call at the same time, same channel, but we rebrand it as the Aries Working Group. I have tentatively created in the Aries working group, in the Aries space on the wiki, space for the other, you know, next week's discussion. Is there anyone opposed to making this change, or feels like we need to have a different venue or adjust those as necessary as we get that started?
I sort of think that that'll be confusing to me. I think there's a lot of work in Aries itself to get ready for that. And I'm just wondering whether there should be a separate call for Aries, and then the Indie Agent Group continues on talking about the same things it talks about, like practical matters and moving message families forward, dealing with hypes and so on. And then once the hypes get moved over to be RFCs in Aries, and a reasonable amount of code is in there, because I just think there's a crossover. There's two different purposes needed to move the project forward.
Thank you, Steve, for sharing. Other thoughts?
No, I think you're right. I think it does check out.
So, was someone about to speak? Sorry. Okay, I have I've attempted some idea to write down some ideas about the how I see this perhaps progressing. There is no omniscient wisdom in what I've written down, but just thinking about the different types of work that needs to go on and what it actually might happen. One of the easier things that to move, I think, is the this call. My hope is that we can invite others into the Aries community that are reluctant to join the Indie Agent community as we begin discussing these things. And there's certainly some ongoing work we want to keep going in the indie space, or rather, we don't want to interrupt what's going on in order to sort of have a big runaround about Aries. The thought that I had in phase one was that the calls could be rebranded as Aries and continue as such. And then the also as part of phase one would be the RFC repo and an RFC process, and then bring over the relevant indie hypes and for a ratification process. And the idea here is that these concepts have been both incubated and demonstrated inside of the indie community, but we want to make sure that the larger Aries community has an opportunity to suggest or to be involved in the process of accepting those as the broader Aries community. There's no assumption here that just because it was done in indie means that it has to be precisely that way inside of the Aries community. And so the idea there was that these two things would be part of phase one and can be executed relatively rapidly. And I think with minimal disruption. Phase two, another thing that I think is highly able to move sooner rather than later is the agent test suite. This would be extracted from the indie agent repo and split from any agent code base and live in a new repo by itself under Aries. And then it's possible too that there's a handful of things that topics that are part of Aries that bleed. There's SDK discussions and there's maintainers discussions and things like that. And it may be that some of those calls end up morphing or changing slightly to move over to Aries. And it's occurred to me, for example, that there's several different types of calls that we have inside of the indie agent community, but we don't all call them the same thing. For example, we talk about sort of standards and interfaces a lot, the message families and how we want to develop that. I mean, our credentials exchange message family work has been an example of that. And we also have conversations about development. And these are younger and growing, but for example, the discussions of reference agents or the agent test suite itself are often semi-different from the conversations about the growing standards. And so this is a sort of a look around and see if we might be able to do that a little bit better. Phase three, and these are not entirely independent phases. We don't have to include them, and there's some parallel work that can occur here. But one, two, and three are increasing levels of difficulty in my mind. We also have some work to split the Indy SDK and extract the Aries SDK portions of it. And that's longer ongoing work as well. As well as the we've discussed the Indy Catalyst agent being a reference code base for this as well, and moving that code in there and making and abstracting the interfaces for any ledger specific portions. If there's portions that rely on Indy right now, but you know, adjusting the architecture so that that is easily replaced by something by some other ledger or mechanism for doing so. So there's work to be done, and that this stuff is longer. What I would hope to be a good timeline for sort of all three, although three is a little bit ongoing, is to have by next IW, so we're talking 6 months, to have a beta version of the Aries SDK and perhaps the Indy's Catalyst agent that has swapped out the Aries SDK for the Indy SDK in the repos and available for for ongoing community work and effort. This is all completely rough, just me attempting to apply the work ahead of us and sort of sort out what might happen sooner or what happened might later. Stephen, you've mentioned that it might be worth keeping the calls separate for now, and that way we can continue the momentum of the Indy agent call without relating to Aries topics, and then keep the Aries calls at a separate time and focus on the things needed to for that community.
Yeah, I mean, basically, there's two different bodies of work, major bodies of work. One is getting Aries all organized so that we can move forward. And then there's the nuts and bolts of moving agent DIDCOM, basically DIDCOM forward, agent to agent communications, the work we've been doing for the last while. I think it might be helpful to keep those as separate efforts, but obviously with a bunch of crossover, but open to discussion, obviously, but that's my thought.
Yeah, I'm in support of that, just because I think the split work is going to get kind of derailed by our need to keep the momentum going. And I think by separating those, we can bring people in earlier who want to focus on how do we attach to other ledgers and things of that nature, while still keeping the DIDCOM protocol work going forward. And then once the Aries stuff is ready for DIDCOMs to be bolted on top, then we can start proposing hypes using the process that you suggested.
My worry in doing that specifically is that I'm hoping that the DIDCOMs work as we go forward is the precisely the work that we want to involve the broader community in. Our conversations at IW indicated that there were not need for major changes there, and that by addressing that now as part of an Aries adoption RFC process, that we can involve that conversation. So what we could do is have a new call where we begin discussing, migrating Indy hypes over to Aries RFCs and keep it entirely separate from this call, from the Indy agent call. And then as that goes, we can sort of decide when that cutover is. The thing that worried me was that the community for this call and the community for that call where we're discussing those things is a ton of crossover. So now we've increased the call load rather than for those that are interested in those topics, which I believe is a larger portion of the community. And so I was trying to avoid creating new burdens and new work that needed to be done as part of that process.
Maybe what we could do is, I think that there's a lot of crossover for some of us, Sam, but right now there's not deep crossover for everybody because we don't have repos stood up and we don't have processes well understood in Aries and so forth. Maybe what we ought to do is have like a crossover on the indie maintainers call or something along those lines. And then as soon as we get to a point where we think a cutover can be effective for the general, you know, interested party about agent work or something, maybe we come back and announce it.
We could. I was hoping to carry forth the momentum from IW. And in that vein, in the next several days, we should have the Indie RF, or it's not the Indie, we should have the Aries RFC repo in place. And begin having those conversations that, you know, about ratifying those standards like the wire level and message typing and things like that as a broader community. So, as far as moving code bases, that's a longer project. In recognition of that, but I think that doesn't preclude the conversations about the standards, which is what I was hoping to keep the momentum on.
Yeah, it is important to say that there is we have accomplished something really important in the indie agent community, which is that we have real momentum. We have a lot of people showing up to these calls. And the very argument that's being made, hey, you know, we don't want to dilute our momentum, could be made the opposite direction, which is if everybody shows up to the indie agent calls, but nobody shows up to the Aries calls, then a lot of the benefit of this community gets diluted, because really what we want to be accomplishing is to make the work on DID communications and so forth as broadly applicable as possible. And if everybody in indie kind of stays in their own private world, I think that we lose some goodness.
So, Sam, have you spoken to any of the people that were looking to adopt these types of things to come and join? Because I know we mentioned that this is the call for them to come and join, and I don't see anybody on here.
So we haven't announced an Aries call or published this on the Aries list yet, so I don't know if that's really as indicative as we'd like of who will or will not come. I also think that I've had privately expressed a lot of interest in attending and joining in. So from what we had happen when we launched the original indie calls, I would say be patient, wait 3 or 4 meetings before we see whether or not we have more folks glom on to what's going on.
Certainly. I'm just thinking about, what, practically speaking, what are we going to be doing for the next 4 or 5 meetings? Because I think there are 2 different things that are going to overlap, and we are not going to be able to put them all in the same call. If we're talking about moving credential 0.1 into a 1.0 phase or something like that, I think that makes sense for us to keep those conversations going. But I don't see someone like you, Port, coming in and adopting that stuff right away. It'd be good to have them on the call, but until we see that, let's not go hurting our momentum just for the sake of hope we can invite others.
So a couple clarifying things. This call that we're on at the moment was not the call that I was looking to invite people on. It's really close to IW, and we don't have the, you know, 2 days has not been enough to get the 2 days has not been enough time to get the infrastructure in place for the call, like the wiki and stuff like that set up, which is what I've been doing for the last 2 days. So next week's call was intended to be the original one, and should we decide to do that, then that outreach would happen the end of this week to help them prepare. And to Nathan's point, it might take them a week or two to get there. But a stronger point here might be, what do we actually plan on discussing over the next 2 or 3 indie agent calls, and how much overlap would there be with who we hope to involve from the broader community? Open question.
I mean, I'd personally like to see us continue moving forward with the credential stuff. I know I've already posted the DIDCOMS library that Joe has published to NPM over in Diff, and there's quite a few people taking a look at it. They're probably going to start working on building POCs. So practically speaking, that's what they're distracted with right now, is trying to integrate that stuff so that they can send a hello world message to an indie agent. And then when they're ready for it, you know, we'll know, and we can start kind of showing them, here's basic message formats, here's all the protocols we've integrated, and the things of that nature. So this is why I'm advocating so hard for, let's keep moving forward with our verifiable credentials work, because we know what we need to get done there.
Well, one of the conversations that I think would be useful to have with the broader community is we discussed the forward options we have with the wire level format about moving it closer to a JWE format, or whether we are going to more or less hold on with what we've got until MLS, the message level security, the message equivalent to TLS actually shows up. And that would be a discussion that I would want to have with the broader community. And I feel like this is the timing within the next couple weeks is good for that. Certainly the credential week work needs to improve and continue. There was a handful of message families created for the demos that I would love to hear about. There's some action menu stuff that the BCGov folks did, and I would be interested in hearing about that. There's also ongoing. I don't know when the next one's scheduled is yet, but there are diff integration talks as well, trying to sort of organize the efforts to produce or to identify a common workflow that we all work to support as far as credentials exchange goes. And so that is kind of happening at the same time, and I feel like there's some relevant topics that could bring up as well. I don't feel like the content of every meeting needs to be oriented towards people that are just joining our community. I think that having a healthy mix of both new topics and old topics would help there. And my hope is that by making an effort to extend invitations and to involve people in our meetings, that it feels very much like the indie community is welcoming and wants to join with others in the Aries community to move things forward and as part of that process. So I think we have a couple proposals here. One of them is that we do in fact keep this call at the same time, but called the Aries call. We would make some modifications to and include some of those new topics and make sure that there were portions of each meeting that were broadly applicable to the Aries community. The other proposal is that we keep working in the indie maintainers call and then as we reach the level necessary, then we can discuss actually either doing a rebrand or starting up new Aries calls. Other options here that are worth considering? Okay, those seem like the two options. Of those two options, is there a vote one way or the other? Do we use hands or something? What's the best process to do this?
Zoom has a chance for people to raise their hands if you look at the participant list. So you could call for a vote and see how many people raise their hand.
How about let's do in the order that I presented, please hit the raise hand button. In the Zoom participants list, if you want to rebrand the call immediately starting next week, and then just for sanity, okay, I've got one hand up. I'll give everyone a minute to find that if you don't have that. Okay, so. Still flooding in here. So I've got six, seven. People are still finding hands. I'll be patient here. So I have seven hands raised at the moment. For rebranding immediately. Okay, if you will, everyone put your hand down that was that had it up. We'll wait for that to clear and then ask a raise of hands for those that would like to delay rebranding the call until the indie maintainers call feels like it's a more we're ready. raise a hand if you want to keep the indie agent call branded as it is and delay that until the indie maintainers group feels like it's sufficiently set up. Got a couple of hands. Let me be patient for any hand seekers out there. Okay, I've got two. So if you intend to be raising your hand for this one, you want to make sure that's raised. Okay, I've got three up. I want to pause long enough to make sure we get anyone who wants to vote this way to get their vote in. Does anyone want to vote and can't find the place to stick your hand up? That's a reasonably good question.
Okay, I think you should call it.
Okay, so I've got four. Troy just slid in the door there. So I've got four voting to wait till the Indie Maintainers call feels like it's ready. And I had seven in favor of rebranding immediately. I abstained from a vote. Any comments? Are we running fast with scissors here? Is there something else we should be discussing about this topic?
For what it's worth, the DidCom stuff I was planning to continue in the DidAuth group. So if you want me to propose merging that over this way, I can do that. We'll see how readily accepted that is.
Well, what DidAuth group are you talking about? Are you talking about one at Diff?
Yes, there's a DidAuth group that the majority of people who show up to that call have generally accepted the idea of have said that they're going to take a look at integrating the JWE stuff.
The wire level.
Yep.
So the only comment that I have there, I'm less picky about the venue and I'm more excited that the conversation is happening. The problem there is DIF calls are closed. This call would be open. So anyone is allowed to come and discuss. So from an outreach perspective, I think that's an appropriate place to continue outreach efforts. But for discussing modifications or changes or anything else, I feel like it's important to have that on an open call.
For what it's worth, they're not actually closed. Anybody can show up. Like, Matter is not a part of the DIF, but I still show up. So, like, practically speaking, yes, but it's only as good as the enforcement layer.
Yeah, I mean, that might be true. It makes me uncomfortable, though, that involvement goes against the community's own stated rules. So that might be practically the effect of it. It still makes me a little bit uncomfortable.
Yeah, I guess for me, I'm just concerned about getting the work done. I don't really care. I show up where I need to get it done.
I don't know that those conversations should stop happening, but I think that if we're discussing particularly any changes that need to be made or future direction of that work, my suggestion is that it happen here in this call.
As I said, okay. I'll propose it. No guarantees.
Okay. And we're very interested in feedback. I mean, we've called the vote. I think we should do a rebrand. And I will be involved between now and next week on both helping to set the right agenda for an initial meeting and to extend make an effort to extend invitations to other groups that we hope will participate, and then a balance of topics between the ongoing work that has happened in Indy and the topics that we feel we need to approach with the broader Aries community for ratification there.
Can we, Sam, move on to the last agenda item? I think Oscar wants to talk about the peer did spec, and if we have 15 minutes, I think that would be a good use of our time.
Yes. Anyone opposed?
I'm available for that, yes.
Okay.
Yep.
Oscar, you're the one that put it on the agenda. Do you want to frame it? I have the documents that I can share to the screen, unless you already were planning to.
I can share as well. So
okay, go ahead.
Thank you. So just to remind people, one moment. Let's see whether I'm sharing the correct screen now. So as people may have heard, Daniel and I have started a discussion on the peer did method. So the discussion got very confusing because we got all types of arguments in the category of Your Honor. I was not in the neighborhood. And if I was, I didn't kill her. And if I did, it was self-defense, which is a very hard argument to do. So to structure the discussion, last meeting, I presented the discussion, the decision tree. And I hope this is readable for people. Yeah. So the main argument, it starts that if you use the cryptographic method of the cryptographic UUID in the peer-did method as it's currently specified, that there are some troubles. And of course, if it's just a harmless method, then why discuss it? But and then once we say that, then we can go to the argument it's need to have. For instance, it saves you from a man-in-the-middle attack, or it's nice to have. The, for instance, you can do NWise with it, or it's just there. So so I started the discussion on the first argument that there is trouble in with the peer did. And at this moment, the discussion is between Daniel and me, and it's highly confusing because Daniel continues saying, I don't understand your argument. And I said, well, this is what I read from the spec. So this is my comment on the spec. And then, I'm misreading the spec and I mean something different. And so we are still here. So the thing that I've done is the decision tree for argument one, I've split it up in yet four more sub-arguments, a problem about collusion, impersonation, poisoning, and verification key loss. So the first argument is about collusion, where Mallory and Nadine share some things, and together they fool Bob into saying that they have both a driver's license and a certificate of good conduct. And of course, Mallory doesn't have the certificate of good conduct. She's trying to reuse Claire's. Based on this first argument of mine, there is some discussion happened, and I still need to respond to Daniel's latest comments. But what I've done is I've tried to rephrase Daniel's comments in terms of a question. Like, so some other DIT methods or all other DIT methods have the same problem. So why are we discussing this here? And then there's my answer. And in many cases, I've done that. Doesn't your alternative for peer DIT have the same problem? And then I'm saying, well, this argument is not about the alternatives. So the same process continues that I'm arguing that impersonation is possible. And of course, Daniel says I make all kinds of assumptions that are not in the peer DIT spec. But on the other hand, Daniel is making also assumptions that are not in the peer DIT spec. So again, we are confused and we are discussing a lot of stuff that's not in the peer DIT spec. And one of my arguments is that, well, people cannot read Daniel's mind. So anything that is not in the peer DIT spec, it can be interpreted by a third party like I do. Anyway, some of the arguments that I got from Daniel, they are violating the discussion rules that we have set up, because one of my problems was that in the earlier discussions, I was sent on wild goose chases that hypothetical changes to the UUID spec were made, which are not actually there. And so I'm calling this out, like, okay, happy to discuss those arguments, but only at the right point in time. And of course, again, Daniel disagrees with me. So it seems that Daniel and I, we're not getting very much further. Daniel argues that the Peerdit spec is squeaky, squeaky clean. There is not any problem, any of my arguments are totally bogus, make no sense. I don't understand Peerdit. And obviously, I'm in a slightly different position. So we desperately need third parties that have a look and that do a sanity check on these arguments. So still the main goal of this particular document is to find out whether there is any reason to have a closer look at the UUID method used in the Peerdit spec. And okay, I'm not going to go much further. We have a third argument about portioning of a Peerdit, and the fourth argument of signing key loss, and also a lot of some general discussion things that that were not related to any of the arguments. This is my presentation so far. So, any questions?
Can I comment also, Oscar? Is that okay?
Sorry, who's the person speaking?
Daniel.
Thank you. Yeah, sorry. Here's the participant list that I can see who's speaking. Yes, Daniel, please go ahead. I hope I haven't misrepresented our discussion too much.
No, I think it's pretty fair. I would not argue that the Peerdit is completely squeaky clean, nor would I argue that all of your arguments are invalid. I do think that there are certain aspects of the spec that have been misunderstood. And I do think in a couple of cases, you're saying this isn't in the spec, and I'm saying, yes, it is, because the spec references some other materials that describe them in greater detail. But you know what? The big thing for me is I'm not feeling like the first argument is very helpful, because I don't understand every one of the arguments that's been brought up feels to me like it applies to all DIDs. Like the possibility that you can lose your keys. Well, of course you can lose your keys. Every DID method could do that. So, but you're trying very hard to not let me argue that this is true of anything else. You just want, in the very narrow context with our blinders on, of saying, well, the peer DID method spec with the UUIDs has this problem. And if that's the true narrowness of the argument, we can just go on to argument two. Of course, okay. you can lose your keys with the peer DID spec, but every DID spec has that problem. So why is that a relevant observation?
Well, my problem is, first of all, your statement, all DID specs have that problem. That is a statement. Okay, I don't know what's the proper qualification, but I call it a wild goose chase, because then you're sort of arguing that I should look into all the other DID specs, including the absolutely useless ones, and confirm or check that. I call that a wild goose chase.
Doesn't have to be studied. It doesn't. It's just a nature of key management as a problem, that any key management based solution has that characteristic. Isn't that obviously true on the face without reading any specs?
I claim that the Peerdit spec has some particular problems that are related in the fact that there are no third parties or ledgers involved.
Okay, but that's not pulled out in your arguments. All of the arguments that you're making are examples that are not unique to the Peerdit spec.
My problem is that I think that the Peerdit spec is more important than all the other DIT specs together. The reason for that is that it is by far the cheapest DIT that you have. That is namely a DIT that you can make yourself. So I think peer DIT spec needs to be good. And I don't care whether all of the others are flawed. I think that the peer DIT spec needs to be good.
Can I ask that we like not have you two just like dominate the argument and we go through the document?
Yeah, sorry. Then,
because like I'm taking a look here and I said that I would take a read at this and I emailed you, and now since we're discussing it, I figured I'd talk about this. One of the more interesting points in 4.1 argument is that you say Mallory and Nadine share the full set of DID stuff, peer DID keys, etc. One of the things that is very interesting about this is that it doesn't highlight the point that the link secret is shared, which the link secret would be necessary to share in order for Mallory to prove she has some sort of capability. And that would also mean that Nadine would have to share the exact same link secret, at which point these two basically merge their complete identities together. And if we're saying that's true, what you're saying is Mallory and Nadine now share the same financial data, the same health records, the same driver's license data, every single credential that is of high value or of some value, that to the point where it's issued with credential with a link secret, is not or is being merged together. And so I think that's one of the flaws that I see in that specific statement there.
Can I just give a little bit of an opinion on a couple of the points that you've raised, Oscar, as well? I think it comes down to probably the need to have greater qualification around the purpose of the spec and surrounding assumptions that are out of scope of the spec itself. And I think it's potentially where you and Daniel have a difference. And for the record, I side with Daniel's view on the boundaries of concerns that the spec should have around proper key management and flaws that might be DID spec wide. I think there are potentially some preconceived assumptions that need to be made more explicit in this peer DID spec around key management and those types of problems, which I think you're pointing to. But I'm not sure that they need to be fleshed out in their entirety in the spec, because there's a whole history of cryptographic key management. And I mean, that's the topic of DKMS largely in terms of how you manage keys at the edge. And I'm not sure whether or not you want to conflate that entire topic into here so that the peer DID spec answers all the questions. I don't think it should be regarded as a one-stop shop. I think it should be a spec that is well-defined and has its own scope and points to other resources that solve the other aspects that it's not directly related to.
So I have a similar view that I want to offer to Tobias, in that if this is a discussion of the peer DID method, then discussions of things that are broadly applicable to every DID method, I think, represent rabbit holes for discussion that might be valuable, but not really within the scope of the peer DID method itself. And the view that the peer DID method is more important, I think I agree with you. But when it comes time to debate losing keys, for example, I mean, this is a really, really deep rabbit hole. And I think that refusing to acknowledge outside discussion of those topics will grind the overall conversation to a halt. I do feel like the spec needs to be well stated within its scope, but having to defend every concept present in DIDs and DID docs themselves and every DID method, I think is unfair to an evaluation of the peer DID method as it stands up against the other ones. And it
Sorry, Sam. The purpose of the first argument is only, is there a reason to go to argument two? Because Daniel has argued that peer DID has a benefit against man in the middle, which I disagree with him. he tells me that it has, so it's neat to have against man in the middle, which I don't understand and hence don't agree. He argues also that the peer did method has is very beneficial for NWise, which I don't understand. But the whole reason that we have argument number one is there any reason to look at those arguments? Because maybe I'm right, but if the peer did method is completely harmless, if implementers cannot be confused by the text that's currently there into doing something stupid, then there is no need to discuss that. Yeah, so at this it's only a stage gate to the next stage. Do we want to make explicit why peer did in its current form helps against men in the middle? Do we want to go there?
I agree with your evaluation, but I think it's unfair in that first gate to consider issues that are prevalent to all did methods. And that's where I think the rabbit
I can live with that. But shall we then just close argument one? And I don't know where we want to go, because if we say all did methods have serious problems that are unsolvable, then I'm not sure what forward direction you're proposing. Should we now go into the man in the middle discussion? Should we call this discussion off?
Well, I think that any having a gate in the front is not a problem, I think, so long as the gate is a reasonable gate for the discussion. And I feel like it is too expansive in its discussion. I think it's a little hyperbolic to describe that or to claim that there are serious problems with all did methods that cannot be solved. Like, for example, saying that if you lose your keys, then you don't have access to the key anymore is a serious problem that is not solvable is a little bit of a hyperbolic claim. So
maybe I've made the argument bigger than needed, and I would be happy to delete some of the sections because they are not relevant. But let me take, for instance, a case where Daniel says, well, the losing, the abuse of that key is should not have happened because the key should have been deleted in the first place. Then I'm saying, hey, Daniel, what you're saying is not in the spec. And then later we have a discussion. It can be used for NWise, for which purpose you need to store your key at least for some time. But then his other argument was, no, you need to delete the key. So my whole problem is that I'm getting into a wild goose chase of arguments where the various arguments are contradicting each other. And I'm saying that if I don't understand it, then some implementers of this spec will feel misled because they are doing something and then they hear that they have done something stupid because they didn't read Daniel's mind.
So can I just ask... I'm trying to figure out what he doesn't understand, because I'm noticing something that I walk into quite a lot, which is I don't understand something and then I try to argue about it to try and learn something, and maybe that's where this is causing problems here. And so what I want to figure out is what part of the specs don't you understand that need clarification?
But hang on, point of order.
Point
of order. We're past meeting time.
Yeah.
Okay. And so I would like to continue this. I have this document open, and I will be reading and commenting on the document itself. And I think it's worth continuing this very conversation in the document, or in other venues as appropriate, so that we can address these. And the points about people not understanding them are good, and we need to evaluate these things. But I think I think we also need to avoid on one side of the argument or another. A rabbit hole that's entirely impossible to get to the bottom of. So let's keep having this conversation and engage in the document. And I will commit to diving in as well and offering points that I think can help the conversation, so that it's not just the two of you discussing it. And Kyle has offered to do so. And I think that if others in the community are willing to jump in, that would be excellent. But at this point, I would like to end the call. Are there any 10-second parting comments?
Whose room is this? I don't mind staying on, Oscar, if you and I want to just chat about it, or if others do.
It's fine. And I'm happy to continue the recording. Even if I drop off, it will continue until everyone in the meeting ends. Okay. But then anyone can drop off that needs to be gone, which actually includes me. I have a hard stop. Okay.
Do you need the room as well? Because I can hop over to
it. I do not.
Okay.
I do not. And then it'll end up as part of the recording, and anyone can go back and review it later as well.
Gotcha.
Sounds good. Let's call this an official end to the meeting then. Please be involved on the Indie Agent and on the Aries channels and Hyper in the Hyperledger Rocket Chat, and also in this document, which is linked in the meeting notes. And we will see you all next week.
Thanks, guys.
Okay. I'll stay on as well if people want to continue talking about the peer did method.
I'll be there.
Okay.
Can I just, I think we can simplify this a little bit. This won't completely simplify it, but let me just say this. Of the specific sub-arguments that you have made, I think that the key loss one is basically irrelevant.
I agree with that. Because that's just completely, for all cryptographic secrets or secrets in general, that is a problem. If I'm playing 20 questions and I forget the object I came up with, I can't continue the game. So it's like forgetting a secret is a problem ubiquitously across all information theory. And so trying to make that argument, I think, is a bit of a stretch.
But I think the poisoning argument is more interesting, and I think the collusion one is more interesting, and I think the collusion one is one that we might be able to actually, both of us might be able to move in our mental models and come to a new understanding that would be helpful. So my suggestion is that we spend our time talking about the collusion and the poisoning, but that's just my suggestion.
Okay. By the way, we agree that key loss is a generic problem, so no argument there. However, my argument is that in the case of peer-did, it has specific consequences. That is that in my interpretation from NWISE, which is different from Daniel's, but that's yet another argument, but if you lose the key and you're in an NWISE relationship, then you cannot extend that NWISE relationship. And of course, this is my misunderstanding about what Daniel means by NWISE. And so I have to reread his spec again and again. But my problem is that there is so much not in the spec that I can misinterpret. So I'd be happy to discuss the other arguments, but I think that key loss has specific consequences for peer did that are different for other did methods.
Okay, but let's bring, can we agree to bring that one up when we talk about NWISE and not before? Because until we get the NWISE thing sorted, that argument is not going to be helpful.
Sure. Then, this one...
Let's just defer that so that I'm not saying that we have to say that there's, I'm not disagreeing with your point that there might be a unique consequence. I'm just saying we can't evaluate the unique consequence until we have a shared understanding of NWISE. So let's defer that one.
Okay. Sure. I've added that, so I can live with that. Of course, this means that we should get to the NWISE discussion sooner or later.
Right. Okay.
So shall we go to the poison
collusion?
One? Yeah.
Okay.
So can I try framing what I understand the argument to be as an outsider? Because I noticed when you guys started talking that you guys were very deep in this discussion. And so what I want to try and do is frame it to make sure that we have a common understanding of the problem first, before we talk about the nuances of the problem. Is that acceptable to both of you?
Yeah. Yes, please.
Okay. So my understanding of this is that when you're saying collusion is possible, specifically what you're saying is that two entities two agents that are owned by separate identity owners or separate entities are operating together within the same domain and acting as a single identity domain, even though they are not logically the same in terms of who they are intended to be representing. Is that correct to both of you?
Yes.
There's a lot of words there, but yeah, it boils down to Mallory and Nadine can create a composite identity that benefits one or both of them.
Okay. So there's something that I found interesting with this that I think plays into how we prevent man-in-the-middle attacks today, which is essentially when we're doing certificate authorities, we sign across a specific domain. And that domain resolves to some sort of dynamic IP address. And so that domain name logically maps in my mind to a DID of a domain name or a DID of a domain as we view it in DIDCOM's world. Does that make sense to both of you?
Okay, I missed that.
Okay. Have you seen the DIDCOM's discussion? Let me just send you a link here real quick. I know it's in that Hypes 0028.
Kyle, while you're doing that, let me just say what you said about a link secret is relevant, but it's not quite as strongly relevant, I think, as you assumed, because this spec is not written just for people who are using link secret based credentials. People who are using other styles of credentials need to have a solution as well.
So I see you're adding this here, Oscar, and yeah. I think this is a very important point because what you're talking about is the breakdown of personas. And one of the things that I think the link secret does is causes a naturally convergent property where if you logically separate your identities into two separate fragments of identities, you completely undermine the capabilities of ZKP technology because you can't logically identify the difference between a malicious attack and a valid attack where I'm trying to separate two personas. And so I think one of the nuanced requirements of link secrets is that you should only build off of one, or I would actually go strongly to say that you must build off of one link secret in order for a verifier to identify when they're receiving credentials from two separate entities.
Well, there are all kinds of assumptions. For instance, the word should means that Mallory should be playing by the rules. Mallory is not playing by the rules. So for instance, Mallory could say for her driver's license or certificate of good conduct, like, hey, could you issue this? And by the way, my link secret has changed, or maybe I've lost it, or etc. So Mallory could have the same credentials issued to both link secrets. And so the question is, what does an issuer do when a person asks for the same credential for a second link secret? This is a very deep question. It's no longer related to the peer-DID stuff at all, but this is the collusion thing.
So how is this enforced? Solves this. So I want to point out something. So the point of the rule of saying one link secret is not to prevent Mallory from doing something malicious, but rather so that the DMV can detect when she is. So if we say that all identity owners must use a single link secret, then whenever a verifier receives a credential with two separate credentials or two separate proofs because they're combined using two separate link secrets, then what that means is the verifier will recognize I have to receive two proofs to do this, which I don't trust that, at which point I'm not going to accept and reissue a new credential. Does that make sense? So it's essentially the DMV is relying on this rule to be able to detect maliciousness in Mallory.
Okay, but I still don't understand. Mallory can lose a link secret that is valid because she can lose anything. So she can go back to the DMV, like, sorry, I've lost the link secret of my driver's license. Here's the new one. Can you issue me a new driver's license? And a few weeks later, the same thing happens again. Is that allowable or not?
Yes, and each time she does that, the original one would be revoked. So at any given time, sure, there's still a one-to-one relationship between a human being and a link secret.
Yes, but I think Daniel brought up an interesting point as well that we don't really consider, which is what happens when we don't use link secrets, because I look at link secrets as being one of the capabilities to prevent these types of things, but I don't know how you would handle that when you're issuing to a public DID and then communicating that over a peer DID.
So I just want to say this. The line that says Mallory and Nadine share the full set of DID stuff, peer DIDs, keys, whatever, I want to grant that that's possible. I think that there, it's much harder than many critics of credentials believe for a number of reasons that we don't have time to get into, but I'll just grant that it's possible. Okay.
Okay.
My concern is the next line. I don't understand why we think that that somehow makes it possible to do the next part of the collusion. So read the next line with me. Nadine uses the set to set up a pairwise DID. And that part, that's the part that doesn't compute to me. How is she using one pairwise DID to create another pairwise DID? Like, there's no relationship between them.
So I guess the way I interpreted this to mean is that Nadine is using the agents that represent both Mallory and Nadine to set up a pairwise DID and contain the keys of each individual agent within the peer DID that she sets up with Claire. Is that what you meant, Oscar?
They share everything. So yes, all the signing keys, all the DID documents. So the DID document for the pairwise DID with Claire and the document for the pairwise DID with Dave, they're completely the same.
So when you say share everything, one of the things that we explicitly state in agent-to-agent communication is that keys are not to be shared, specifically signing keys or private keys.
Sure.
So how do you logically see that these are being shared? Because at this point, there is no way to logically identify them as two separate agents if they're using the same key, because the key is the identifier of the key of the agent. The public key is
correct, and we are hitting some very fundamental stuff here. That is, so first of all, how do they share it? Well, they just download all the Hyperledger stuff. And they built their own agent, and they built a fork that does all the nasty stuff and that allows it. So they can get, they can just create two agents that happen to create the same peer DID, the same private keys, etc.
So with this, there's something that I think about with this, which is if somebody is going to that much effort, I acknowledge that they can probably do this because software is software and there's no way to prevent it. So my question to you would be, is this such a big problem that it prevents the entire system from being trusted? Or is it a problem that verifiers should consider and should put in some sort of recourse methodology to deter this, but not absolutely prevent it? I guess what I'm trying to say is, if you're always shooting for the silver bullet, you'll hardly ever find the solution you're looking for. And so if we look at it and go, people can do this, that, and the other to be able to become malicious. Yeah, it's also possible for me to illegally torrent, you know, movies and stuff like that. But the mainstream people don't do it. And the media people who produce movies are still willing to accept that happens because they make enough money on the mainstream media. or on the mainstream consumer?
Fair question. At this moment, well, let me first comment on the cost of this attack.
Okay.
I mean, this is just a piece of software that, and if it has any usefulness, it will be made by someone on the dark web and sold for a few dollars per download.
So this is to my point, how many people actually even know how to get on the dark web? Is it enough where it undermines the entire trust of the system?
I don't know if it's
fair question.
I don't know if it's that much, but in the context of this argument, if I think it's enough that it's worthy of consideration. So I wouldn't disqualify this as an argument just because it seems somewhat marginal. I think it's believable enough, but I'm still stuck up on I still don't understand the sentence that says Nadine uses the set to set up a pairwise DID. I don't get it. Every pairwise DID is created independently.
No, it's not. That's my whole problem. So Nadine uses the same signing key with the same resulting in the same peer DID in both cases. She can do that. And she shouldn't do that, and a proper agent shouldn't support that. But we're talking about security here.
So I'm going to restate your sentence so that I really am understanding it, Chris.
Okay.
What you're saying is Nadine creates a duplicate DID document with Claire that is exactly the same DID document that exists between Mallory and Bob. Am I understanding it correctly?
Yeah.
Okay. So she doesn't need all the full set of DID stuff. She doesn't need any credentials to do that. All she needs is one thing. She needs a private key from Mallory, nothing else.
Sure. So that's also exactly what the picture says, at least the signing key. But they're good friends. They share more.
Okay. But when you said the full set, I thought there was some significance to everything else that you were trying to convey here. Okay.
Oh, no, no. So I can... share...
Okay, so then your next bullet point is Mallory now has a credential about... basically, there's two credentials. One is issued to Mallory and one is issued to Nadine. And they should not be combinable, and you're claiming that they're combinable. Am I understanding it right?
Well, I don't know what you mean by the word combinable, but for some business transactions, you need more than one verifiable credential from more than one issuer. And those two issuers are disjunct entities, which means that the thing that is getting signed are disjunct things.
Yeah.
So it is not a single verifiable credential with a single signature by a single issuer. No, it's two verifiable credentials with two signatures, one of each of the issuers.
Okay. So
I'm getting confused on the actors here. So we use Mallory and Nadine in the first one, bullet three. And then we use Nadine, and then we jump back to just Mallory's use cases. Is Mallory the malicious person in this?
Mallory and Nadine are both malicious. Mallory wants to become the money truck driver, for which she needs both a driver's license and a certificate of conduct. And Nadine helps Mallory to get her certificate of conduct, good conduct.
Okay, gotcha. And so then Mallory, Nadine gets the credential at first, but doesn't sign up for the job because Nadine has the capability to get the truck driving license. And then Mallory is the one going for the job where she goes and gets the truck driving license reissued to her as well as the employer license, but she shouldn't have been able to work for the company and to actually drive it because she's not actually capable of driving a truck. Is that the scenario?
Correct. At okay. least she needs any money truck driver needs both the driving license and the certificate of conduct. And either of them has only one of them, so neither of them should be the driving the money truck.
Yeah. So I think the assumption that you're making on which this abuse case rests is the assumption that the basis for issuing a credential will not provide adequate protection. So the DMV is probably not doing enough verification to prevent the abuse at the time of issuance. Or are you saying that both credentials were issued legitimately?
Well, this is where I really need to understand. So if Nadine is using the same signing key, the same peer did, etc., in the relationship with the county, then I would expect that Nadine would be able to get, Nadine was getting the certificate of conduct from the county. And then it's issued against all the stuff that Nadine and Mallory have shared with each other. So if it's issued against the peer did, then that's what they share. If it's issued against the signing key, that's what they share.
So when you say issued against the peer did, are you thinking in terms of like a JWT style credential?
Okay, now you're going beyond my understanding.
Okay. What did you mean when you said issued against the peer did? Because with the ZKP style, you issue against the link secret. And the only ones that I've seen that issue against the did itself is the actual JWT. And so I was trying to understand what you meant, and it may not have been either of those.
As we discussed before, I'm happy that it's issued against the link secret. I have also seen in some of the W3C stuff that verifiable credentials are issued against a public did.
Yeah, so let me try to summarize this. There's two strategies for issuing credentials. One binds the credential to a did and one binds it to a link secret.
Yes.
And in the case of a did being the binding, it would have to be a public did. It could never be the peer did.
I agree with you, but the peer did spec doesn't say that. So I think that at least the peer did spec should have a big warning signs that, okay, the peer did spec doesn't have some of the properties that some other dids do have.
So can I rephrase that to say that it's not practical to issue to a peer did because you don't need a verifiable credential if you're in a peer relationship because you already have direct contact, and the point of a credential is to prove something from a third party provenance.
Okay, this is going beyond my understanding. Okay. Say it again.
One of the advantages to a verifiable credential is that I can go to an issuer who is not in contact with the verifier, and I can get them to sign something, take data that they gave me over to the verifier, and the verifier never has to contact the issuer because the verifier can get that data from the ledger. Now, if I'm issuing to a peer did, it doesn't make sense to issue to it because the issuer is the verifier, and that logical separation doesn't matter. Where this becomes interesting, though, is in the NY stuff, in that you could set up a use case where I could issue a credential to a NY's did that is discoverable by multiple parties. Think like an employer and an authorization server issuing me an employee credential. And then I go take that to another server that's within the company domain and I can verify it, but I never have to attach this to the ledger because the verifier can still discover the information necessary to verify the credential without having to contact the issuer. because they're able to discover the issuer's public keys.
I feel like that's Kyle, I agree with everything you said, but I feel like it was a really dense set of words that's kind of hard to parse. Can I try to say it a little bit simpler?
Yes, because I'm still trying to figure out how you actually tell this story, so I'd love somebody to simplify it.
So a pairwise did, if somebody is issuing to a pairwise did, then they're issuing to an identifier that is used in the pairwise relationship between the issuer and the verifier. I'm sorry, holder. Let me start over. If an issuer like Acme Corporation is giving something to Alice, the holder, and it's giving it to Alice using a peer did, then it's giving it to a did that's known only in the Alice-Acme relationship. So when Alice then takes that credential and shows it to somebody else, they're going to shrug their shoulders and say, well, we don't have any way to verify the signature of this did, therefore it's kind of irrelevant to us. The only way that issuing to a did makes sense is if you can prove ownership of the did in some other context when you plan to prove things. And so
who is the party that needs to prove ownership of the did?
The holder. The party that holds the credential.
Well, Mallory and Nadine can at all the time prove the control of all the signing keys.
But who are they proving it to? I think that's where the logical separation comes into play. Is if I'm proving it back to the person who issued it to me, which is true in the case where there's only two logical identity parties, because what you're saying is Mallory and Nadine are operating together as a single identity owner, which is how they trick the issuer to get that credential in the first place. So if I'm taking that credential and reproving it back to the issuer, what value does that get me?
I feel like
silence again. We are here in a complex situation where many people have different understandings of what things are. So, in one occasion, I get to hear peer dits are never reused between three parties, and then I'm saying, well, hearing yes, they are. That is called endwise, and then we decided to defer the endwise discussion, so suddenly it's no longer there. I continue to be confused.
So the reason I brought this up is because Daniel's statement I didn't think was nuanced enough in saying that it makes no sense to issue to a pairwise did. And I agree, it doesn't make sense to issue to a pairwise did, but the peer did method spec also supports the endwise relationships, in which case it would make sense to potentially issue to a peer did.
Yes.
So I sympathize with your frustration, Oscar, and I apologize. We're doing our best, and we're really not as logically inconsistent as it sounds, but there's just so many layers of assumptions here that we have to peel these back. And sometimes we say things in a way that is overly broad, and then we have to walk back what we said because we have to nuance it more. Let me try it this way. You said that Nadine and Mallory possess all the key materials and everything so they can prove the state of their DID document and their ownership of a DID.
Yes.
But who can they prove it to? They can only prove it to the other party or parties that have received that DID doc from its inception. They can't prove it to a random third party that shows up later. Can they? Did you imagine they could?
You can do it later as long as they can discover the keys. And that's another nuance. Yeah. So like, think of it as a group where one person joins the group later. They can still discover the keys, and after they've joined the group, they can verify it.
Kyle, I'm going to have to nuance what you just said.
Okay.
They can't totally do that, because although you can prove that you have a key, and this gets to several of the things that Oscar said later in his document, although you can prove that you have a key that was associated with the DID document at one point, you can't prove that that's the current state of the DID document without talking to the other party that's seen the DID document evolve from its beginning.
Okay, so this is like the consensus. Interestingly enough, MLS actually solves this problem, but
yeah,
it does it by doing what you're describing. It's saying everybody has to accept the truth.
Right. So let's not assume that, and let's not get into that detail too much. I just want to say this. If Acme Corp and Nadine plus Mallory together have a relationship, and Nadine plus Mallory are able to prove that they possess a key, and let's just assume for simplicity for now, it's never been rotated, okay? So they have the initial signing key upon which the DID was based, and they've given a DID document to Acme Corporation, okay? And let's say that the value, the numeric value of this DID is 123, okay? Now, they receive a credential and they go from Acme Corp to some new corporation, Bob Corp or whatever, and they want to prove something. How would you imagine them proving that they are the current owners of that DID? Would they use the private key that they both share to say, look, I'm signing with the DID that's, or I'm signing with the key that's named in the DID document, and I'm going to show you the DID document I have with Acme Corporation so you can know that I have the latest version?
Well, the thing that you're now asking me is to give my interpretation of the peer DID spec, and my whole problem is that I don't know why the UUID method is there in the first place. So what I've been doing so far is making my own interpretations, like, okay, how would a naive developer be using the peer DID spec with all the claimed advantages of the UUID? And every time I'm using it, I'm getting said, no, you're doing stupid. That's not what we meant. So I have a difficulty of explaining to you how I think that the peer DID spec is working.
Okay. Well, I apologize, and yeah, I understand your frustration. So I will just make this claim. Mallory and Nadine cannot prove to Bob Corp that they are the possessors of that DID. The only party that they can prove it to is Acme Corp that they established the relationship with in the first place.
Okay, and here again, I'm not understanding something. Why can't they prove it? Because, I mean, maybe they set up the relationship with Bob first and only Acme later. How do Acme and Bob know which one was first, since Acme and Bob, they are not talking with each other, because one of the is the issuer and the other is the verifier? And
so what you're describing is essentially, how do they discover the key to verify the signature? And so this is where it becomes a problem, is because when you're talking about things in a specific peer relationship, there's only me and the other party. And so if we're making that assumption, then the other party issues me a credential. So let's use this picture specifically. If Claire is the only one who can discover did peer 1 YTEF, then when I go to Bob and say, look, I have this credential signed by Claire, Bob is not able to actually verify that Claire is the owner of that DID that signed the credential to DID peer 1 YTEF. Bob would look at it and go, how can I verify this is actually Claire who signed this, and it's not just you who created a second peer did and signed a credential to yourself.
Yeah. So what you're essentially are saying is that if a naive developer makes an implementation of peer did where he makes an assumption that the UUID method has the magic property that it allows this scenario, then you're saying it's wrong. So apparently this is not the way. So at least we have established that at least one level of uselessness of the cryptographic UUID method.
Because
this is not the application.
I would argue that it's the same for both, because what you're doing is you're inherently assuming that because that did is named, that Bob will be able to discover and trust it. But there's nothing that says that Nadine and Mallory can't create a named did that imitates Claire's did property. And so that property is equal whether or not it's a UUID based or a human readable did based.
Yes. So we agree that we may agree that stupid implementers may think that the UUID based method has any benefit in this case, whereas if we and then the stupid developer is wrong. When we used the simple did without the UUID method, and we just warn the developer, like, note, it's only unique within the context of the relationship, never else, then the likelihood that the developer makes this mistake is lower.
I didn't quite understand what you meant, so let me try rephrasing it back to you. What you're saying is that by deriving the identifier from the key to create a UUID, there's an implicit baked assumption in there by a stupid developer that they are logically coherent with a identity who they believe it's from that could be impersonated.
Yes.
Okay. I think this is where I differ, is that I think that assumption that's baked in can be made in both ways, and as such we should clarify, and I don't think this actually acts as a good argument to delineate between a UUID and a human readable identifier, because they both encounter the exact same problem.
Sure. So we agree about that. However, the probability that the developer is making the mistake is smaller in a method that doesn't has a security section 4.2 that claims something about global uniqueness, etc. So I have to so in that sense they are not even though the method doesn't make a difference, the method misleads.
Okay, I see what you're getting hung up on here. So because the UUID is called globally unique, you're equating that to mean that it's also globally discoverable. Okay, so are you assuming that a developer who's making this assumption, or that a developer would make that assumption, and that is why they would assume that because they are logically different in our views, but to somebody who's on the outside and is looking in, they may look at it as logically the same because they're looking at that uniqueness? I'm trying to understand first.
Well, I'm trying to understand too.
Okay.
And the problem is that we're always getting to the NYs. So the spec advertises, hooray, this peer did is specially suited for NYs. However, it's not suited for NYs in any of the ways that Oscar, being a stupid developer, is using it. It's only usable for NYs in a way that people who can read Daniel Hartman's mind can use it. And I think that's not acceptable.
I mean, you're going to run into that problem either way.
I mean, I go and read GitHub stuff, and I can't assume what Daniel Buckner is thinking. So this is just a part of, like,
yeah,
good tooling will explain what is being thought. And so I think what your argument is, we need to explain these things better.
Yes.
Which is perfectly acceptable. I mean, I don't think Daniel Hardman has ever asserted that the peer did method spec is perfect. I think what he'd like is to understand where it's wrong, which is part of the reason we're trying to understand where you're viewing it, so that we can look at it and go, here's how I'm viewing it, here's how you're viewing it, and we can cover the delta easier and accept that burden of covering the delta between where we think that you're misinterpreting it and where we intended it to be interpreted, because we can see both sides, whereas you can only see your side because you don't understand our side.
Have I lost you? Well, the same is true symmetrically, because every time I make an argument, Daniel says I don't understand your argument. So, but as for my motivation, I think that the peer did spec is extremely valuable. I think it's valuable, more valuable than all the other did specs together. So. Mm-hmm. That's the reason why I want to make sure that everything that's in there is useful and well understood.
Yep.
So and that's the contribution I want to make.
Okay. And this is part of the reason that I don't think that this should really be an argument format. It should just be a transfer of knowledge. Because when you put it in an argument format, we're inherently saying one is a winner and one is a loser, but ultimately trying to figure out is how do we share the knowledge and come to a common understanding.
Sure.
But we're doing that in a debate format.
Yeah, so I would be happy to stop any argument and go into the knowledge part. However, the thing that I want to avoid is all kinds of wild goose chases, because I have taken Daniel's emails to one of our crypto experts.
Mm-hmm.
And that crypto expert couldn't make any sense of it. So that means I just took all the emails of Daniel on the man in the middle attack and say, well, please explain to me how this man in the middle attack works and how the UUID solves it. And he could not explain it to me. He said, well, it's not clear, not from those emails. So I really, at this moment, I don't understand it. And
Daniel, let me ask you, Daniel, a question here. When you're saying UUID solves the man in the middle problem, what did you actually mean by that? Because I actually tend to sign with Oscar that it doesn't. I just think that the UUID property is valuable to understand the root of trust of the DID doc.
First of all, I don't call this the UUID thing. That's Oscar's term.
Sorry, okay. I don't know what is the most compact way of calling this, then I will change all the documents.
I would say a key derived identifier.
Okay.
I don't really
care that much. Okay.
We can use whatever term you want, but the reason I pointed that out is because part of the problem here is that people are using terms that I didn't create, and they're claiming that that represents my thoughts, and then we're getting in a hopeless muddle. Yes. Another phrase here is globally unique. We mean something very different by that. At the moment of creation of a DID that is derived from a private key, if you know that the private key is unique, you also know that at that moment, the derived DID is unique. It is true that it's not guaranteed to remain unique. But when I said in the peer DID spec that DIDs are forced to be globally unique, I didn't say forever. I just said they're forced to be globally unique. And in my mind, I meant at the moment of creation, not some other time.
Yes, but
I didn't say that, and that's a valid critique to say that the spec assumes something. But the phrase globally unique then got carried, and Oscar is pointing a finger at me saying, you said that global uniqueness. No, I didn't. I said global uniqueness one way, and then that phrase got reinterpreted other ways, and everybody's trying to point out how that's not true. So it's just, we have to be really precise here.
Yeah, so Daniel, it is not at all my intention to send you on any wild goose chase. Like none of the wild goose chases that you caused were intentional, but still it happened. So that's why we need to be careful about those. That's why I came up with the discussion rules. And of course, maybe the format of argument is not a good format. And then I'd be happy to go to another format.
Well, I think the format's fine. The point that I was trying to make is let's not look at this as an adversarial nature where one is a winner and one's a loser.
Oh, no.
Let's look at this as let's figure out how we need to edit the spec so that we can make it so we can lower the bar of entry to be able to use this spec in the way it was intended.
That has been my goal all the time.
Okay. Well,
but still, in terms of argument, I need yet to understand and to be convinced that the signing key derived value of the long thing that Daniel said that has any need to have nice to have properties. And so far, I still don't understand.
So the main one, and I'm not sure if this has been highlighted, that I've always thought about having it, is that by knowing that you can derive to the root key, because if you say that the identifier has to be defined based upon a public key, which is associated directly with the private key, then I generate the private key, and then I publish the public key in the DID document so that when I look at the identifier, I can recognize that this is the root DID document and that there is no previous history before then.
And well, so I disagree with you about that.
Okay.
Because the person creating it, so if I roll my dice, create my signing key, and do all the stuff that's in the spec, then I know for sure that nobody else has that peered it value. However, you don't know that. Of course, you can trust me, but the whole point of verifiable credentials is that you don't trust me.
So I wouldn't bring in verifiable credentials in here.
Oh, not okay.
The reason why is because what I'm thinking about is, remember when Daniel was mentioning the addition of a new person requires both parties to accept the lineage of the DID document from origin up to the current point when you're creating.
I recognize that argument. By the way, that point is not present in the DID spec.
Okay, that's fine. So we've highlighted a point that we need to go explicitly state.
Yes.
So these are what we're trying to discover is these types of things.
Sure.
One of the important factors is if I am the new party that's coming to join this peer relationship, I am basically taking at word that these two are not colluding, which in some cases could be very dangerous to me when I'm trying to conduct a relationship in the future. So by explicitly linking the origin key to the identifier, what I can do is I can look at the identifier of both parties and I can be certain, even though I joined, to know that I have reached the origin of both parties and I can verify that.
Okay, I don't know what origin of both parties means and I don't know what the word verify means and what is the benefit that you get from that. So, okay. So far you have just described how it works, but not what is the reason why it's useful?
Okay, this is excellent. So what I'm doing is I'm learning how to explain this. So I'm doing it on the fly. So bear with me here. Essentially, what it is, let's say you and Daniel have set up a relationship that is pairwise. And so it's you and Daniel who've been having a conversation back and forth for a while. Daniel's rotated his keys a few times. You've rotated your keys a few times.
Well, actually, I've done more because Daniel wrote in the discussion document that after the creation of the peer debt value, I should immediately and safely discard that original key and then delete it. So so I've done all the things. So I've rotated the keys. I've deleted the original key.
Yep. So now you've got a did doc that has maintained two states, and so does Daniel, because you're forced to delete the first key on rotation or on setup.
Yes.
So Daniel has two states on his did doc, and you have two states on yours. And now,
What does two states mean?
So it's gone from the did doc with the first key to the did doc with the second key added and the first key deleted.
Okay.
So you've got state one with only the origin key, as I've referred to it in the past.
Yeah. Okay.
And then you've rotated that key to a new key and deleted the origin key. And so that has placed you, jumped you from state one to state two.
Okay. Yes. Correct. Yeah.
And so both you and Daniel have done that. Now I'm coming into the conversation, and what I want to do is I want to verify everybody's conversation, but I don't know where you're at in state. I don't know if you're at state two, state 50, whatever.
Why is that relevant? Why is that any of your business? I'm just creating a new DID pair with you, and Bob is doing the same.
Because it's not a new DID pair. You're bootstrapping a in-wise relationship, which is what we're describing right now, on top of a peer-wise. And we may need to go into in-wise before we can go.
Okay.
First of all, do you understand the idea of bootstrapping the in-wise relationship on top of the peer-wise relationship that you and Daniel have already set up?
Yes, it's actually adding a third party to our twosome. Yeah,
exactly. And so as the third party...
Wait.
Go ahead, Daniel.
This is a subtlety of n-wise that I want to make sure we're all aligned on is the following. Every party in an n-wise relationship identifies all of the other parties with the same DIDs.
Yes.
That is the definition of n-wise. It is different from having a bunch of... It's different from having n pairwise relationships. In n pairwise relationships, the parties have pairwise relationships with each other, but they don't have a common identifier that they can use. So like in a three-wise relationship, when Alice wants to talk to Bob about Carol, Alice and Bob both use the same identifier to talk about Carol, even when Carol's not in the conversation.
Yeah. But okay. By the way, I was not understanding why why we need to have a DID for that, because the mutually identify each other is just an attribute. It's a claim. So maybe I should continue trying to understand what you're saying. So you're saying that there is a usefulness, that there is some usefulness in having an n-wise relationship where all of the parties within that context, each of the parties has only a single DID identifier.
Right.
So, and yes, and then we can have a lot of discussion whether that's useful, but okay, the premise is that it's useful and we want to bootstrap that.
Correct.
Yes.
Okay.
So the idea behind this is, now that I'm the third party that's joining and bootstrapping on top of your guys' peer-wise relationship, particularly because one of you invited me, because I don't know about your relationship until one of you decides to invite me and tell me about it.
Yeah.
What's going to happen is I'm going to come in and look at it and go, okay, you know, how can I verify the state and all the keys? Because what happens if you issued a credential? We're going to get really confusing here. So I just made this up. What happens if you issued a credential to Daniel in Peerwise? I don't know why. And then Daniel invited me into the relationship and tries to use that credential to, as the holder, tries to provide me with that credential. And I'm going to verify it by looking at your past keys that you signed it with. And so I need to know all of your past keys in order to verify that credential.
That is a confusing situation. Let's use a simpler one.
Okay.
Alice, Bob, and Carol. Carol's the third party to arrive. And Carol just needs to know that there's not a fourth man in the middle or some party lurking around that's pretending to be either Alice or Bob, right? So she needs to know that she has a shared understanding of who she's talking to and that her understanding matches what everybody else thinks.
Yeah. And here's where this is particularly important is when, if an agent is represented by a public key, then I want to know all the times that you've added and deleted agents so I can know the lineage of which or agents I should trust right now.
Yeah, so one possible attack is for a bad guy to get in the middle of these three people and claim to be Alice because he has Alice's original key, the one that Alice deleted.
Yes.
And he, you know, he contacts Carol and says, hey, I'm Alice, and you can know that this is me because, see, my key is tied to the DID doc. This is one of the abuse scenarios that Oscar was suggesting is possible. So,
right.
The way that you guard against that is that you can't take any one party's word for it in that relationship. You say to Alice, or the person you think is Alice, Alice, what is your DID doc state? And Alice tells you, you may or may not believe it at this point. But then you say to Bob, Bob, what is Alice's DID doc state? And Bob says, well, here's what I have. And unless both parties are lying to you, a man in the middle is going to be detected because Bob will have a more evolved version of Alice's DID doc than the so-called Alice did.
So, Daniel, let me just try and understand. So I can resolve any party in the NWise relationship can contact any of the other ones to resolve any of the DID documents. So if Alice has rotated her DID document with all of them, then, okay, no, this can't be what you're saying.
It's actually kind of true. You just don't necessarily know if it is Alice's current state. So if I'm Carol, and Alice and Bob have been communicating back and forth, I can go to Bob and ask for Alice's current state.
Current state means try and resolve her DID document. Is that correct?
Yes. Okay. Yes, that's correct. Or I can go to Alice and ask for that. And this is where the pairwise relationship flips kind of the paradigm of things, where I now become the verifier because I've resolved the DID doc. And so I'm looking at these as two differentiating states. And I'm going to go, would I rather trust Bob's view of this or would I rather trust Alice's view? Or I may look at it and go, I trust neither. I'm choosing to delete this connection. And so in most cases, you're not going to trust Bob's over Alice's. You're going to trust Alice's. But if you recognize that differentiation, that's where it's going to be important because you're going to perform a secondary check, which is, do I trust this relationship at all?
So far, so good.
But I mean, this is a beautiful mechanism, but still, I don't know how it relates to the fur key, the thing that I shouldn't call UUID because it's the wrong abbreviation. I still don't see how this relates to this method. I mean, I can do all of this without that method.
Because here's where it becomes important is because Alice and Bob could agree on the same current state, but how they got to that current state could be different. So I need some way to verify that they've been in the same state the whole time since the origin of the relationship. If I can't verify that, then I can't trust that some agents were added and some were deleted. And I can't understand the relationship of what happened and what data may have been passed, which is where the, yeah, the micro ledger, essentially the micro, go ahead, Daniel, you may be able to add better clarity.
So the problem, it basically, you can prove that evolutions were legitimate based on the keys that existed before, but you can't do that for the initial or genesis state. If you say that the way that you're going to create the DID is you generate it from random number or something, and that you pick a set of keys, and those keys are unrelated to the DID, then there's always the possibility that there was an earlier state that you can't know about. But if you say the DID is derived from the keys, then you can know with 100% certainty that there was not an earlier state that you have to track backwards. Does that make sense? It has nothing to do with
N1. Well, but I still don't know why it's relevant. I mean, I hear a lot of technical properties that are caused by the special method, but I still fail to see why it's relevant. I mean, the DDOs, the DID documents, they have a numbering, a version number. So we have version 1, version 2, version 3, etc. So the version number already says enough. I mean, there can't be a version 0 or minus 1 because why that's not how we count. And also, I don't understand why is having the full history of a DID, of all the keys of a DID, relevant? I mean, the whole purpose of key rollover is that you don't keep the signing keys anymore.
It's so that we can get the immutable property that we get from ledgers in a peer-to-peer fashion. So the same reason I want immutability on a ledger is the same reason that we want to track back to the origin of the peer-wise relationship. So it's like saying, why do I need a Genesis transaction file on Bitcoin or the Genesis transaction file on Indy?
Yeah.
It's so that I can track the lineage of all changes to the state over time that everybody recognizes.
Okay.
And that lineage is what gives the legitimacy.
Okay, what I'm hearing is completely new for me, and I didn't see that in the peer DID spec, but if this is the reasoning behind it, then at least I understand it. I still don't understand why we need it, but I understand that this is a way of tracking it.
Okay. So,
but still, I don't understand why just using version numbers don't achieve the same goal.
Because version numbers can be asserted by anybody.
Yes.
Well, the whole point is, if you don't trust me, you ask somebody else. And Mallory or Nadine can create a different origin.
Do you agree with the assertion that trust is built up over time?
In general, yes.
Okay. I have to drop to another conversation. Yeah. So you guys continue, but I'm going to be quiet. I might come back and you'll still be talking, but I need to drop off for a little while.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you, Daniel.
Yep. Thank you.
And Kyle, thank you for taking so much time for this. It really helps.
Well, I love that you're questioning these things because it really if we create things in an ivory tower, where nobody can understand it, it's useless. And there's no point in even wasting our time creating it. So I love that you are questioning these things and trying to get a better understanding, because it's forcing us to come up with the answers that make common sense. So to that point, going back to where we were talking, if trust is built over a lineage of events or over time, I kind of just conflated those two ideas there, which are fairly similar. The idea that I can trust back to a certain point is important because it allows me to understand the history of the relationship. And this becomes particularly important when data is being shared that occurred before the relationship was set up, or before I joined the relationship. So say, for example, Alice and Bob are passing messages back and forth, and then Alice decides she wants to share a message with me. Being able to track, you know, when that message was signed is important for me to be able to verify, you know, this is a legitimate message, not one that Alice just made up and she's trying to impersonate you about.
Wait. Where does the timestamping come from?
The timestamping is not necessarily timestamping in the sense that you'd normally think about it. It's an implicit relationship between the key that was used to encrypt a message and my ability to see where that falls in terms of the state ledger, I would say, or the micro ledger of when that message was sent. So, for example, if Alice sent a message and encrypted it to your second state, so your second key that you've created, and then you take that message and send it to me, I can verify that this message was sent to that state at that time. And so I can look at that and understand where you guys are at. Did I lose you there? I feel like I almost lost myself there.
Yeah, it's hard to parse. At least so far, I've gotten to understand the concept of microledger slightly better, even though it's not really a blockchain-y type of thing.
Yeah, it's more like a publish-subscribe model. Where everybody can subscribe to everybody else and everybody can publish to everybody else. Yeah. So it doesn't require consensus.
But there are a lot of concepts that are explained here, and I would really like to see a document where what you're explaining me is explained in words. Because the peer-to-peer document doesn't do justice to all the thinking that's behind it.
Yep, and this is because a lot of this is just like for example, where I was talking about the credential that was issued in a peer-wise and then I joined in-wise, I literally just made that up in this conversation. because I realized that's another possibility with it. And so this is where I look at the peer-did method spec and I go, this is rather early in its thinking.
By the way, we have been talking about NWISE for quite a while, and NWISE is in the category 3. That is in the category nice to have, because in many cases you're not doing NWISE. Is that correct?
I would not be able to come up with another way to develop an NWISE relationship other than bootstrapping off of a peerwise first.
Yes, I understand that, but the question that I'm asking is, of all the use cases that we foresee in the future, how many of those will be based on NWISE, and how many of those pairwise will be good enough forever?
I'm not really sure about the second for pairwise. I know of one specific use case that I really want to build, that's based upon NWISE, which is the ability to do control of access management within an enterprise without having to use a ledger. And that requires an NWISE relationship because I have to be able to discover all of the keys of all the other employees in the organization.
Okay, but that didn't answer my question. Let me ask you it otherwise. Does pairwise have any use? So you and I, we set up a pairwise DIT relationship, and it will never become anything else than pairwise. Does this have any use?
Yeah, I think this is used quite a bit. We use it in text messaging. It's essentially an end-to-end encryption format.
Yeah, I understand that. So the thing that I'm the reason that I'm asking you this is because apparently there are applications where pairwise is enough. Can I call it the UUID method? Because I don't know, Daniel objects to me calling that, but I don't have another shorthand for it.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying, which is
okay, so do you agree with me that for a pairwise relationship, I don't need the UUID method?
If you are certain that the relationship will only exist as a pairwise, I think I could buy that argument, but I am not certain how many times that a pairwise will not turn into an NWISE.
Well, your argument is completely inconsistent with an argument that Daniel made at first. He says peer DITs are extremely cheap. So if I need to, I'm in a pairwise relationship with you, and then I wanted to expand to NWISE, then I can just create a new DIT relationship with you and make sure that you understand that it's the same person. I mean, I can have as many DIT relationships with you as I want, or as we want.
Yeah. Do you mind if I take like a really high, like tangential question here?
Sure.
What is the specific motivation behind having human readable DITs?
Sorry, it's not about human readable DITs. My motivation for questioning the UUID method is that I don't understand its usefulness. I have the suspicion that it's never a need to have, and in many cases it's a nice to have. And that it can mislead developers in doing silly things. So I have the feeling that in many cases it's just not needed.
Okay, I think that's a fairly reasonable argument, and specifically the second one where it could be misleading. But I always think misleading comes from poor documentation, in my experience.
Yeah.
If you document right, then it can't be misleading.
Well, that's my reason why I'm offering to help with the documentation.
Yep. For the point around the nice to have, I think you could make that argument. But one of the reasons that I intuitively lean towards let's add this in is because we will recognize cases where this is necessary. And by having that necessity, such as when I'm bootstrapping the NWISE relationship, by forcing everybody into it, you create a consistent alignment. So what I would think would create more complexity is if we said, if you're setting up a peerwise that will turn into an NWISE, then you have to have this UUID method or UUID identifier. But if you intend for this to only stay as a peerwise relationship until the end of the time, then you can do UUID or the other one. And for me, I look at that and I go, that's a decision tree that I would rather just eliminate and say, because one can cover the other as well, why not just use that only one? Even though it in your mind, what you're saying is, I prefer the other one because I'm not sure when I actually need it. Does that make sense?
Yes, I think we are getting somewhere. Okay. By the way, the argument that you're now making is the so-called harmless argument. If there is absolutely no harm in doing the UUID method, then why question it?
Yes.
Yes.
So I'm willing to kind of move outside of this format that you had set up, because for me, what I'm really trying to understand is, where do you see the holes? Where do you see the problems? Where do you see the inconveniences? And we can kind of work from there.
The main inconvenience that I see is that so far we have seen different interpretations, and that so that there can be different wallets that have different interpretations of what the peer did is, because their developers had different interpretations, and suddenly they make wrong assumptions. So for instance, one very clear one is that if somebody else presents me with a peer did, that I make the assumption that it's a unique one, and that I can identify the relationship by the peer did that is presented by the other. And I think that's wrong. Only I can make sure that a peer did is unique in a relationship. So the other should say, well, should not refer to his own peer did, but should refer to my peer did, the one that I created, because then I'm sure to what context at my site is referred at.
I'm not sure I understood that. Let me try rephrasing what I think I understood. So what you were saying is that because there's a peer-wise identifier, that the identifier that I choose to share with somebody else, they can't recognize it as globally unique, because the uniqueness property essentially has no purpose, because it's more about the discoverability, which is the global or the N-wise or the peer-wise. And so what you're saying is that the uniqueness, since the uniqueness doesn't matter, I shouldn't be concerned with that, and I shouldn't constrain around that, because that could cause possible misinterpretations.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a very good summary.
Okay. And this is where I look at it and I go, the reason I've tended towards the UUID side of things is because I can't predict the contextuality over time. So let's throw out a very weird example of where this may occur. Let's say I set up a peer-wise relationship, and then I start issuing credentials from that peer-wise relationship. And then all the holders who I issued credentials to, let's take a step back. I made a leap in logic.
Okay, yeah.
There. Let's say I issue a credential to a peer-wise person. So there's only two parties in this relationship.
Sure.
And then let's say that I now turn that relationship into an N-wise relationship, where that did that I issued with the credential to, so let's say I'm Alice and I issued a credential to Bob. And then we add Carolyn, and now it's become an N-wise relationship, and I issue a credential to both, to Carol as well. So now Bob and Carol have credentials to me, but they're the only ones who can verify those credentials, or me, Alice, but it's literally only Alice, Bob, or Carol. Now let's say we make another evolution where we start adding in three or four more people. So we're still in an N-wise relationship. And all these people go, look, I like this credential, but I want to go share this with people without having to bring them into the relationship every single time. Do you mind taking that same DID that you issued all of these with and publishing that to the ledger? And what you can do is you can basically change the context over time as you see fit. And so if you take something that is in violation with a greater context, it's going to cause issue with the capability to do that, to the point where I can't go and reissue, or to the point where I have to go and reissue all of these credentials when I jump from one smaller context to one larger context, because the global context requires global uniqueness.
Yeah, but the thing that you are saying is that apparently the price of reissuing a credential is so absolutely high, so absurdly high, that we need to go through all these hoops to avoid that. That's also a premise that I don't understand. I mean, if I have a driver's license and somehow I lost my driver's license, I can get a new one. Well, the plastic one that will cost me perhaps 10 euros. Getting a new driver's license or a copy of my driver's license electronically, we're talking about a transaction that costs a few cents. So I don't know why we have to go through all these loops and hoops future things.
This is a very valid point. What you're saying is, what is wrong with just deleting and reissuing credentials, which is a perfectly valid use case.
Yeah.
In most cases, you're probably right. That is probably the better way to do it. The thing that I'm thinking about is, I absolutely, when I'm looking at an architecture, I absolutely hate excluding capabilities that I don't see a reason why I need to exclude them. And so that's essentially what I'm thinking about when I'm thinking adding in this property is, yeah, I can see cases where it makes sense to do the logical equivalent of the jump from the peer to the NWISE. And we know that jump requires, or doesn't require, but I would at least assert that it requires the uniqueness factor so that I can verify the origin of the DID doc. And so making that leap from NWISE to globally unique, I think is not necessary. But I think there's a lot of use cases where the peer to NWISE justifies it enough.
Yeah. But okay.
Hi guys.
So far I've been following a lot. But I mean, we are still in the nice to have and it doesn't harm type of thing. But still, I don't understand. Okay, I have a peer-did relationship with Daniel, and I have a peer-did relationship with you, and you also have a peer-did relationship with Daniel. And okay, we want to get it into a three-wise. Then we use one of the two as basis. But still, the third person needs to make a new DID and needs to start a lot of trust again. And also with NWISE, for any NWISE relationship, we're not starting from scratch. A lot of those people that are going to be in NWISE relationship may have already been in a pairwise relationship anyway.
Oh, okay. I see what I think you're after here, which is the ability to merge two peer-wise relationships into an NWISE.
Well,
rather than having
that is the thing that you have been advocating. That is, you can use a peer-wise relationship as a bootstrap point for an NWISE, and then I'm saying, well, there are n minus 1 divided by 2 pairwise relationships that are all not the bootstrap. So they are all to be discarded or be added anyway. So my feeling is that some of the arguments are contradicting some of the other arguments.
Which ones are specifically contradicting in your mind?
Well, the first one is that I'm not reusing peer dits. So if I set a peer dit relationship with you, then the two peer dits that we're using are different from you with Daniel and from so all three. So when the three of us have made all bilateral combinations, then there are a total of 6 peer dits.
Okay. So there's a baked-in assumption there that I don't think we've stated very well, which is you only need to you want that property if you want to prevent yourself from being inadvertently talked about. So say, for example, I set up 2 separate peer-wise relationships,
yeah,
but I use the same did across both, then you two can talk about me without me actually knowing it and without us having a established in-wise relationship.
Yes.
And so this is why you should do that. But if you don't, you just screwed up your own privacy. That's on you.
Yeah, that's the whole point. So for that purpose, we don't need it. And what I'm saying is that using only one of those, well, and you know, this goes with N square. So the fact that you can build on a long lasting bilateral relationship, it's not a valid argument. Because most of the participants in the new NWISE will have to create a new peer dit anyway, even though if they had already bilateral relationships with others. It's only the originating pair that can keep their original relationship. And even for them, why not create a new one? So why is there such a huge value in keeping the same dit, peer dit in one case, but not for all the others in this relationship?
Because it naturally forces a default of doing privacy by default. Like, imagine if you say you don't have to do it this way and you build it this way, and then a developer goes in and goes, okay, well, I'm going to use the same identifier across all of my relationships, and I recognize as an attacker that you're doing that. Then what I'm going to do is I'm going to recognize that because the developer is implemented in this specific way, I'm going to go start and try correlate them. And yeah, that is the fault of the developer and not of the user.
Yeah, but my point is that you can argue either the one or the other, but not the same at both at the same time. And that was my problem with much of the discussion with Daniel. Your Honor, I was not at that location, and if I was, I didn't kill her, and if I did, it was self-defense. Each of these arguments are valid, but in their combination, they are contradicting.
So, either
a peer dit has a value for future expansion, or it doesn't. And if you say because of the correlation properties, you should never reuse, then that is one argument, but then it doesn't mean that, then it means it doesn't have this long lasting value.
So I feel like what I said on this topic has been slightly contradictory. I think that's a somewhat valid argument, but I also think that what I said has been misunderstood. And I would love to have an opportunity to explain that. We're pretty late in the call, but I'm happy to, if you are willing. Can I try?
Yes, I'm available.
Okay. So here's the thing. I think you are right that reuse of peer dids and keeping a did stable when you upgrade a relationship feel contradictory. And they are contradictory in a particular assumption, but I want to suggest a different assumption to you. Okay, so let me start with the specific case that I rooted a discussion in one of our documents, which is about business partners. So let's suppose that we're at the phase of setting up a business where Alice, Bob, and Carol have just decided to become business partners.
Sure.
And let's assume that all of them have an existing pairwise relationship.
Yeah.
But let's assume that Alice and Carol don't really know each other very well. they each know Bob really well, and they've talked by email a little bit, but now they want to formalize their business partnership. This is a new kind of relationship separate from the pairwise relationships that exist with each of these parties.
Sure.
So they're going to create a business partnership relationship, which is three-wise, which is distinct from the pre-existing pairwise relationships that have happened in the past.
Yes.
And the way they're going to do that is through some kind of introduction where Bob, who knows them the best, says, okay, I've started the relationship. Now I'm going to add Alice to it. Now I'm going to add Carol to it.
But so, let me ask you, we start with perhaps a total of six peer dits, because we're talking about 3/2 times two.
Right.
And afterwards, we have 9 of them, because each of them also gets an N-wise dit.
Exactly.
So my question to you is, why do we need to burden the existing six pairwise dits with all the privacy risk stuff of accidentally or reuse, and with the UUIC method, because those initial pairwise relationships, they're not getting reused anyway.
Yeah, this is the thing where you're misunderstanding.
So for those, you don't need the UUID.
It sounds like Daniel.
You're misunderstanding me, because you're interrupting me before I can explain.
Sorry. Oh, okay. Hi, Daniel. Yeah.
Okay. So we take the DIDs that pre-existed, and we'll number them 1 through 6. Okay.
Sure.
Bob creates DID 7.
Yes.
Okay, now he creates a pairwise relationship with Alice. That's DID 8.
Yes.
Okay, now he wants to introduce Carol. That's DID 9.
Yes.
Okay, so DID 7 is going to be upgraded from a pairwise to an N-wise relationship.
You're sure, right, but it was created just at the moment of the business decision, and it's 7. So 1 to 6, they are not N-wise, and they don't need to become N-wise.
My point is that I don't want to use a different DID method for that DID that was temporarily pairwise and then became N-wise. I want to use the same DID method for it in its initial state and its second state. So I want the same DID method to be available to support both states. And it is common to upgrade a pairwise DID to N-wise. It's just the thing that I feel like you missed is, I'm not claiming that it's common to do that with long-term stable pairwise DIDs. I'm claiming it's practically the only way that you ever get an N-wise DID is by starting pairwise and upgrading it in the moment that it's useful.
By the way, this is something I understand from Kyle, how the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, etc. Works. I still need to parse that, but I still don't need understand why. So I understand why you need to have the why you may need the UUID method for 7, 8, and 9. I still don't understand why you need it for 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
I don't,
because I don't want
do.
Two. You don't need it for 1 through 6, but I'm claiming it is desirable not to have two different DID methods where you have to decide in advance what the state of your relationship is going to be and pick method 1 if you know for sure that it's always going to be pairwise, and method 2 if you know for sure it's always going to be N-wise. I don't think you always know for sure.
This is, Oscar, this is why I was talking about the logical branching. He's restating what I was talking about earlier, which is, you're right. It is a nice to have feature in a peer-wise to have a unique identifier. But we also know that once you convert a peer-wise into an N-wise, that you must have it.
And well, wait. There are several things. Because you're going still too fast for me. We agree that we don't need it for. Let's see. There's something happening and off my side. Oh, my laptop is going out of juice, so I really need to get my
charger.
I need to plug it in the wall socket. So please wait for a minute.
Yep. So Daniel, just to kind of catch up, so I walked him through a few of these things. I think this is the nuanced point that he's getting hung up on, is that he would prefer the nice to have support the other, and we haven't done a good job of explaining why that creates additional complexity by having to go through that logical branching of, is this relationship going to go peer-wise forever, or is it going to go peer-wise to N-wise, and then potentially back down to peer-wise, because there's nothing that excludes an N-wise relationship from being downgraded.
Well, right. If Bob, Alice, and Carol have a three-way relationship and Carol dies, it just got downgraded to pair-wise.
Yeah, yeah. So this is where having the uniqueness become be universal across all contextual across all contexts becomes a valuable property, so that you don't have to reset up relationships when you're trying to switch between them. At least that's your and I assertion. I'm not sure he buys that argument.
Okay.
But the nice thing about DID methods, which I understand he wants to keep them together, is that if he believes this to be true, there's nothing that prevents him from forking and changing these types of things. And with the Aries stuff, that's actually even simpler to handle.
Yeah.
Because it's just like plugging in a different peer method spec.
So I have, again, power to my machine.
Okay. So I was just catching Daniel up on kind of what our past discussion is. Essentially what I was saying is, your assertion is that peer-wise, having this uniqueness is a nice to have and not a requirement.
Yes.
And I don't think that is a contested point.
I contest that, but I don't have anywhere in the structure of our argument that we're currently having to do that. I think that's a later argument, so I haven't brought it up.
Oscar, do you mind if he brings it up right now? Because
At this moment, we are not in the structured discussion, so any wild goose chases or whatever is allowed.
Okay, so here's my basis for contesting that. Alice is going to have a record of all of her relationships, and she's probably going to put it in some kind of a database. I think the database is likely to be a wallet or something like it. And she wants a unique indexer for every party that she deals with. Now, if Alice gets a key from, key is a bad word. If Alice gets an identifier from Bob and the value of the identifier is X, and she gets another identifier from Carol and the value of the identifier is X, she cannot use the identifiers for her parties as the index into her database.
Okay, now we have exactly a hit to the point where I am now claiming that you're a sloppy implementer. That is because you are relying on other people for uniqueness, whereas you should have only relied on yourself. Because Alice has a different peer did for Bob and for Carol. So even though if the peer did for the two of them would be the same, she can still distinguish them, because they are using a different peer did for Alice.
But this is
so these are two different contexts.
No,
and
no.
The sloppy thing that Daniel is doing is mixing those two contexts.
No,
and
that is, no, there's no. A good reason for this. Daniel, do you mind if I give an attempt at this first?
Go ahead.
The reason for this is that Alice or Bob and Carol are not aware of each other. So they don't know that they created the same identifier.
Sure.
And so what this is causing is that on Alice's side, who has a relationship with both of them, is that Alice now has to add in this branching logic to search through every single one of her relationships, every single time she sets up a new relationship, to make sure that there is no collision in identifiers, at which point you're relying on a baked-in assumption that the implementers understand this and know to do this.
Well,
so I agree with what.
Yeah, my reasoning is exactly the inverse.
Okay, I'm open to a rebuttal, and then let's let Daniel speak after that.
Well, I argue that the uniqueness in the relationship is something that I decide. So I don't care how many people there are that are called Daniel in Hyperledger. Indeed, I've heard that there are way too many, but that's not my problem. They can identify themselves as Daniel, but I can still distinguish them because I know the one Daniel from the other. Because in my system, I have associated different peer debt to the one and to the other.
Okay, so can I rebut this now?
Sorry. Yeah.
Okay, point one, all other DID methods have this property. So you're arguing, Oscar, that the peer did method should not behave like all other did methods.
Yeah.
And I utterly reject that.
That's exactly what I have been arguing all the time. And I'm arguing that peer did is a very unique did method and it's different from all the others.
I think
it's more valuable than all the others together.
Yeah, but it's not different in the way that you index and store it in your private database.
Well, that is the point. That's the thing where we disagree.
Okay, well then I flat out, you'll never convince me of this one. It has to
be
that the characteristic of DIDs are supposed to be identifiers, and an identifier doesn't need another identifier to be an identifier. It's an identifier by itself.
Actually, Oscar, let me point something out here. The DID spec itself, not the DID method spec, requires globally unique decentralized identifiers. So we would be in compliance.
Yes, peer DID doesn't qualify. So that means that the DID spec actually says that there shall not be a peer DID. Because global uniqueness is something that you can't guarantee for peer DIDs. Mallory and Nadine.
Well, that's in the proposal that you're suggesting, this is true. But in the proposal that Daniel has written, it would be spec compliant because it would rely upon global unique identifiers.
Now I have a hard time of following.
Okay, so what I'm saying is if you're suggesting that the peer did method spec should be able to use identifiers that are not globally unique, we are not the peer did method spec then becomes not did compliant. It's did like, but it's not compliant. And the way that Daniel has written the peer did method spec so far allows for it to be compliant because the DID methods or the DID spec requires that decentralized identifiers are globally unique identifiers. This is
no. What peer DID is giving you is the aura of global uniqueness, and what you're saying is the aura of global uniqueness is sufficient for getting it listed with on the W3C list. And okay, that if getting listed on the W3C list is the thing that you want to achieve.
Okay, we're
but,
again.
But here we are just talking about the aura of global uniqueness. I mean, the global uniqueness of the sovereign of a sovereign DID is guaranteed because there is a single ledger, the global uniqueness of a peer did is not guaranteed in any way.
Okay, could I, several things. First of all, we're abusing yet again the term global uniqueness.
I didn't start.
I was the one who brought that up because I remembered that the DID spec specifically says that a decentralized identifier is a globally unique identifier that does not require a centralized registration authority because it is registered with a distributed ledger or other form of decentralized network.
Okay. So let's just, what does that actually mean? Here's a case where I will show you that it doesn't mean what we've been thinking in the last 5 minutes.
Okay.
If I have a DID ledger, let's say it's sovereign, and sovereign gets forked, now all of the DIDs are not unique. Does that mean that the DID method gets thrown out? No. It means that an event has happened that makes something not unique later. Okay? So, how do you fix that? Well, you fix that by saying, we're going to take one of the forks and give it a new prefix in the DID namespace. Or we're going to do something else. So you have a problem with uniqueness and it needs to be resolved. Okay?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Now, I reject the idea that the peer DID spec is giving an aura of global uniqueness. It is giving a strong guarantee of global uniqueness, but only in a very narrow case. The case is, at the instant when the DID is created for the first time, you know that it is globally unique. You, the creator, know it's global.
Only the creator.
You are correct.
But there is no way of proving to anyone in the world that you are the creator.
We can solve that problem.
Even though I am God, there is no way that I can prove it to you.
There is a way to prove it. It can be solved, but it's not in the current DID spec. So if the critique is that that it's not in the spec, you would be absolutely right. But to say that it's unsolvable is wrong.
The way that you
solve it is that you require the other party that you're creating the peer DID spec with to provide some of the material that's used to create it.
Both Mallory and Nadine can do that.
Yeah, but it's still a unique DID.
The number 5 is also a unique number. There's only one number 5. So what makes the number 5 more unique than or less unique than any other number? All numbers are unique. So what does that argument mean?
So misunderstanding uniqueness again.
Can I rephrase this? My understanding of your argument right now is because we're kind of violating the property, we should just not care about the property at all and we should just throw it away. Now that may be a violent misinterpretation of it, but that's the way I'm understanding your interpretation of uniqueness here.
Yes, I think that the proper implementation should not rely on the uniqueness of the provided peer DID by the others, but only on the uniqueness of the provided peer DID by itself. And that is my claim. And if this means that there is something wrong with the DID spec, then, there are lots of things wrong with the DID spec, but that's a whole different discussion.
So to that point, and I want to let Daniel talk because I realize I just interrupted them. To that point, why do you believe that this uniqueness becomes important? This is what I'm trying to understand is, why do you think we should move further away from the DID spec than remain as close as possible to it? And that's what I'm trying to figure out here is what is the advantage to this where this specific change to the DID spec, to the DID method spec helps you? What is the use case that you want here where this is worth the argument?
My feeling is that, that the peer DID spec with its aura of global uniqueness of whatever it is misleading implementers in doing stuff that they could do with other DIDs but shouldn't do with peer DIDs.
Would you say that's also true for a ledger that has been forked? A ledger that's been forked is misleading implementers to believe that they're globally unique when they're not.
Good question. So at this moment, I'm not talking about Sovereign or any of the other ledgers. I'm only talking about PeerDits. PeerDits can be extremely easily forked.
The reason I was asking this, though, is because you're using this edge case as the crux of your argument, but it's true across every DID method. And what you're saying is, well, let's make it perfect in this one by doing this other thing that's way over here that's not spec compliant, that goes against the general story and general methodology of thinking within the DID community. And you're saying, let's do this just so that I can get what? That's what I'm trying to figure out. Because for me, it's a lot easier to understand, here is the use case I want, and here's the use case Daniel wants, and to look at it and go, here's where the overlap is, and here's where we need to do to find alignment here. Because I feel we're going around in circle and circle and circle around the argument, because not talking in concrete, specific things that we want changed and why we want them changed for a specific use case. Well, there's nothing that says we can't update the DID method when we come up with new DID use cases. And so this is why I'm getting stuck on this, is why do you want this property? And is there something in the DID method spec right now that prevents you from doing it? Not from leads you to misinterpret it, but specifically prevents you from doing it.
Sorry, prevents me from doing what?
Whatever use case you have in mind. So, for example, the use case that you're suggesting or that I've kind of alluded from what you've explained is this idea that you want to be able to take an identifier and be able to move it across multiple identities across multiple peer-wise relationships. And what I'm saying is...
Well, that was not my case. My case was the opposite. That is...
Okay, so go ahead.
I'm still.
All right. So
yeah.
I'm feeling very frustrated. I'm sure you are too. We've tried very hard to communicate, but we have some deep challenges here. I'll just say this: I'm flat out categorically opposed to not having the property that peer did can be assumed to be unique. Now, when the assumption is wrong, and I totally grant that that assumption can be wrong, when the assumption turns out to be wrong, that is a signal that there's a problem that needs to be solved. We do not change the property of the system because it can't be guaranteed perfectly. We only require that people remediate when that happens. If we don't have that property, we can't use a DID as a way to route traffic. It would mean that you would have to communicate the sender at the same time you communicate the recipient, which would undermine all privacy. We simply cannot have that.
Well, that is incorrect, because you have explained to me that we have layering in messages. The outer layer is the routing, and the next outer layer is the encryption. So the next thing, that is who is the sender, what's the DID of the sender, what's the DID of the receiver, is not visible by third parties.
What he's saying is that you can't perform routing. Let's go to a specific concrete use case. If I share a DID in a specific context, so my DID with Daniel is DID X, and my DID with Oscar is DID Y, or no, is DID X as well. The only way that I can differentiate between them in terms of a routing purpose is by also sharing my DID, the sender DID. But if I require that X and that Daniel's DID and Oscar's DID are different, I no longer have to share my DID, because it's not being bound to that. Rather, what I can do is I can rely on that uniqueness to identify within my own machine how I need to route and who I need to send it to, rather than relying on some sort of fuzzy concept of which uniqueness I describe to my own machine, which is what you were presenting when you were saying there's many different Daniels in Indy. you're relying on some external piece of information, which requires more correlation in order to identify those things. And what we're saying is you can get this specifically with the identifier and you don't need other information. Specifically, it would be something like, I'm requiring the first letter of your last name. That becomes a new piece of information that is adding additional correlation points.
Okay, I think I had a poorly chosen example.
Okay. Well, I interrupted Daniel here, though, so I want to let him finish, and then I will let you rebuke what Daniel says, because I inevitably that will happen.
By the way, if the argument of Daniel is, I will fight you to hell and this will never happen, by the way, then we are also ready, because then there is no longer a need to convince me.
Well,
because I'm just a third party who is stupid and doesn't understand it.
You're not stupid, Oscar. You're asking important questions. And the
reason
I'm engaging in this conversation is because I'm learning things. We're finding ways that we have to explain our ideas better. All of that is valuable.
Thank you.
But I really am strongly opposed to the notion that there should be one kind of DID that has different rules for routing and different rules for indexing and different rules for usage than all the other kinds of DIDs. That feels to me like a very bad idea.
Oscar, do you accept that is true? That by doing certain methodologies that you've presented requires us to come up with multiple different method specs to do all of these types of things?
No. And the reason is that at this moment, the semantics of DIT is overloaded. And my whole problem, as I'm saying, the DIT spec is not perfect, and we have all kinds of people who have different interpretations what it is that the DIT identifies. And my definition is very simple. A DIT identifies a DIT document, nothing more, nothing less.
But what is contained in that DIT document, and how do I identify which DIT document I need to talk to, that I need to use? So for example, DIT X resolves to a different DID document when I'm speaking about Daniel than DID X when I'm speaking about Oscar. And that's what we're saying is, if I have two DID X's in my own system and I'm relying on a caching mechanism, my system goes kapoop. I don't know which DID X, which DID doc you want.
Yeah, and it is so frustrating for neither side to be able to articulate the concept to the other. Because so far I have the feeling that despite the many hours that we have spent, that you have no clue what issue I'm trying to raise.
No, I honestly don't, which is why I'm asking for a concrete use case that you're prevented. That's why I was asking for that, is because I do much better speaking in concrete use cases than I do in abstract ideas. The only thing I understand concretely right now is that you want to remove the uniqueness, not even global, but you want to remove the uniqueness from the peer DID method spec, and I don't know why.
Well, I want to understand why it's needed. So I've learned several things. That is because it's useful for NWISE, but the more important argument that I've only learned in the last hour and not in the last weeks is the fact that the way that many pieces of software are interpreting DITs make an assumption about those DITs, about their uniqueness.
That's probably because it's been baked into the DID spec, and that's just kind of been an automatic assumption, and this is the first time that assumption has been challenged.
Yes, and I think that there is a very good reason that it's getting challenged now, because as I keep saying again, the peer DID is special, and it is more special than any of the others. because doesn't have any hint of authority whatsoever. Because for the sovereign, it's the sovereign ledger that is authoritative.
Okay, there's an important point here. The pure did method spec actually does have a point of authority. That point of authority is the other party in the relationship, which is how you end up with the relationship state machine. So if I state something, but you don't accept it as true, if I state rotate the key, but you don't accept that I rotated the key, and then I start sending you message with the new key that I rotated to, you can't verify any of these messages. So the authoritative aspect is the other party. So I don't believe
but,
that.
But then the number of other parties in the world is 7 million, whereas the number of sovereign ledgers is exactly one, or maybe two if we have a fork in the future.
Yes, but
so
on,
I'm claiming that the peer did spec is very special.
Yes,
it's, and I'm claiming that it's more special than all the other did specs together.
Can I assert why I believe it's special? I think it's special because it doesn't require global uniqueness in order to achieve a decentralized network, because it's a peer-to-peer network rather than a global state. The ledger acts as a global state that everybody agrees is true.
Yes.
But the reason the peer-to-peer network works is because it is peer-to-peer and
yes,
it is a subjective truth. It's similar to the idea of, I don't know which fork you're talking about. Bitcoin's been forked about 40 times now. And so that idea of it being peer-to-peer, I don't understand why you want this additional complexity. And that's what I'm trying to figure out, which is why I keep asking for a use case, is because if you give me one where what is written in the peer did method spec right now prevents it, I can look at it and go, okay, I completely buy why you need that. Or I may look at it and go, here's how we adapt what's in there to keep uniqueness, but also fit that use case. But without a use case, I can't look at it and go, here's why we need to change it. It's like saying, you should just change this property and that property because I think it's a good idea. But we, in a logical setting, it's not about what feels good. It's about what you can explain and the reason why, which is why I'm looking for these concrete use cases. If there's not a concrete use case, I just don't understand the reason to create the change, because we've acknowledged that there are specific use cases that require it.
Okay, I've the feeling that I'm so the argument that you are making is that actually removing the UUID thing makes things more complex. So actually what you are claiming is that I'm not removing a feature, but that I'm adding a feature. Namely, the feature that I'm adding is the removal of the UUID, which introduces additional complexity. And since this is additional complexity, you're asking me, what is the use case that justifies that additional complexity?
Yes, that's exactly it.
Okay, fair point. I think this is the point where I should start and do my homework. I've learned a lot. I think I've learned a lot of your arguments. So one of the things that I'm going to try and do is to try and write down the arguments that you've used. And see whether I have understood them to a point that somehow sooner or later they could be added to the peer did spec. Because even if I don't agree with the argument, if I have formulated them properly, then they still have value to the spec.
Yep, exactly. And at the end of the day, this is what we're all after, is a common set of knowledge.
Yes.
And so finding this common knowledge is the concrete stuff that's going to happen, because that common knowledge is going to get baked into the did spec.
Yeah.
And getting these kinds of understanding, I think, requires time. And
yes,
it requires us to listen, which I think, based upon the conversations that I've heard you two engage in the past, this has been a far more constructive conversation. even though at times all three of us were able to derail it. I think I derailed it at the end. I think every one of us has derailed it at some point. But I think that we are getting to a more constructive conversation and we can achieve that. So yeah, I like the idea that you take what you've learned today, go simmer on it for a little bit and see if you can come up with a use case that doesn't, that this UUID method or the unique method violates. And if you come up with that, then I guarantee Daniel and I will look at it and say, okay, let's talk about how we change it to include this use case. Do you agree with that, Daniel?
Yeah. Well, as I'm saying, the latter challenge, I don't know yet whether I will accept that. My first challenge is, so far I have learned two very important things today. That is, first of all, how to go from pairwise to endwise. I now think I sort of understand the method, so I'm going to try and describe it. And so that will be my step one. And the step two is the argument that, okay, this is how the DIT stuff works with indexing, etc. This is also something I'm going to write down and to see whether I have correctly understood your argument.
Okay. Daniel, I know you wanted to speak there too.
The phrase here that is now really frustrating me the most is the phrase global uniqueness. I think it's such a red herring.
Yes,
There is a kind of uniqueness, but it is not the strong uniqueness that people are assuming. We're not claiming a strong uniqueness. We're claiming about the same kind of uniqueness that we mean when we talk about IP4 IP addresses.
Yes, that's a great example.
You have databases where you want to associate some property with an IP address, and you use the IP address as the lookup key, and then you put the property next to it. And yes, we all understand that 10.x addresses are not globally unique, but for the purposes of a given application, it is not sloppy programming to say, well, I'm going to require that you tell me what NAT exists in front of the 10.4 address, and I'm going to put an extra field in my database to say what's the NAT before the 10.4 address, because it's unique enough. And that's the real characteristic we care about, is it's unique enough, not that it's perfectly unique. So I'm just...
Point taken. And I think I sufficiently understand and agree with that.
Okay.
And I agree with the fact that it's a red herring. And by the way, this is the red herring that I'm worried about.
Yeah.
Because the reason is that... naive developers will interpret the word unique in a different way that is much stronger than Daniel just said. And I fully agree that we should not go anything stronger than what Daniel said.
I think the reason it's been baked in globally unique is because every single assumption has been built on a ledger, which is globally discoverable.
Yeah.
And so this is why we've baked this in, but this is an important point here, that it requires uniqueness to a point, but that doesn't always mean that it's globally unique.
Yes.
So I really like that point, Daniel, about IPv4, and I think we can rely on that to constructively move forward with this discussion about how this is going to work, because a 10.0 IP address is essentially what we're creating here.
Okay, so let's continue the conversation. I do have one other thing I'd like to add, and I have been reluctant to bring this up, but just this is not an argument. It's just a piece of information. Last week at IIW, there was a session about the peer DID spec. There were about 20 or 30 people that came to that session. And the conversation that happened was, we ranged over a lot of different topics. We did talk about the method of generating this property of approximate uniqueness that we're talking about. And one of the people in the audience, it was Christian Lundquist from Consensus, raised his hand and he said, well, what about an alternate method where instead of deriving the value of the DID from its key, what if you derived it from the initial version of the DID document? And I am still thinking about that suggestion. It's an interesting idea. It has many of the same characteristics that I care about, and it may actually be superior in several ways.
Yeah.
I don't feel hostile to that idea. If there's a better way to derive uniqueness, my commitment is not to the specific thing of let's take the top, top 8 bytes of this value and turn it into a DID, but rather to the property that I'm trying to get out of it. And there may be better ways to achieve it.
And one of them is what Mr. Lundquist said, that for instance, we take the whole DDO, DID document, and we take the hash of it, and then we use the first so many characters of that.
Right.
Yep. Yeah, I think that's just as powerful.
Well, it may be more powerful. There's a couple of reasons why that's interesting.
You bootstrap the whole DID document instead of only the first signing key.
Right.
Yeah,
and this bootstrapping argument is one that I need to ponder over, but it makes a lot of sense.
Okay.
I think
so. We can just think about that, and maybe next time we talk, we can say if we like that characteristic or not. My first reaction to it was generally positive, but I just haven't had time to think about it deeply.
Yeah.
So one thing I suggest moving forward, let's continue on the documents, and if we need to do another impromptu call, let's do that. I will join so that we can kind of have a slight moderation. I try to moderate and try not to be too biased, but I do recognize I tend towards Daniel's side because that's how I learned it. But I also recognize my bias, and I try to acknowledge that. So if you guys want to set up another impromptu call, let's do that. I would suggest we not do this on the indie call because I've sat there and I'm just like, I don't know what these two are arguing about right now.
Yeah. Well, at this moment, I believe that the ball is in my court, that it is my homework to do, just as I explained. So let's, for the time being, hold off. Of course, other people will still provide input, but I have the feeling that the ball is now in my court.
Yep, and then once you've figured out what's going on, we will work on updating the spec with some of the new language that you come up with.
Yeah. By the way, one, I think it's now time to close, but one thing that we may still need to discuss, which we haven't done, is the man-in-the-middle attack scenario, which is something I still don't understand. But let's not try and discuss it right now because there's already enough in my court.
Yeah, I've thought about that one quite a bit too. So we can talk about that one for another day.
Not now.
I would like to take an action item, but I don't want to do it, Oscar, if you'd prefer me not to. I would like to go update the specific part of the peer DID spec that talks about global uniqueness and change the verbiage to make it clear that that's... we mean something much less strong than that phrase implies. But maybe, do you want me to wait to do that until after we finish our discussion?
No. At this point, we have gone a different direction. So I don't think we will continue the discussion as an argument, but more in the style that we have just discussed it. And in that sense, any improvement, I would be happy to review and give my comments.
Okay, great. I'll do some of that, and I'll send you links to the things so you can review them.
Yeah, and same for me. Well, first I need to do the write down myself, but once we have something that sounds proper, then maybe I will turn it into a pull request. But first I need to check with the both of you.
Okay, great.
Sounds good.
Have a good day, Oscar.
Discussion is getting more constructive. It feels that way to me, at least.
Yeah, I'm really happy. Thank you, Kyle, for stepping in.
Yeah, no problem.
Okay, then I wish you a good day. And yeah, it has been a very interesting 4 hours.
Thank you.
Okay, have a good day.
You too.
Bye.